It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! I'm home!
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster, who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
What a wild time to be a wrestling fan, you know. In the span of 24 hours, we had Christian Cage beating Kenny Omega to win the Impact World title on AEW television. We had Omega defending the AAA Mega title in Mexico the next night against Andrade, who was escorted to the ring by Ric Flair, who just got released by WWE, and who proceeded to chop and punch Omega, and then put Conan in the figure four leg lock. We had Deonna Purrazzo, the reigning Impact Knockouts champion, winning the AAA women's title. Will Ospreay is back, and he still has his IWGP belt, and he plans to defend it. And we are 5 days away from CM Punk's first major live wrestling appearance in over 7 years. These are crazy times. And this is episode 717 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, August 15th, 2021. If you would like to support the show and make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. You guys know where to go there. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out. And I got some fine folks to mention here, including the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, who I hope is having a great weekend. Thank you for the support, Paul. Night Stalker, Naif Alsafar. You know, Naif was up, still up dropping super chats at 8 o'clock in the morning, his time, during my Rampage stream on Friday night. I had to tell him, go to bed. Go to bed. Thank you, Naif. Big Bear, Bryant Becerra, Killshot, Keith Hart, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, John Raging Mad Riffle, who dropped a couple of PayPals this week, so thank you to John. And shout out to Chris McDonald, who celebrated a birthday on Friday. I hope it was a good one. Also, congrats to Guitar Hero John Kiernan, who was interviewed for the most recent issue of Pro Wrestling Illustrated for a two-page spread on wrestling theme music. That is very cool. You've heard me mention John's name and his music before here on the podcast. He actually has a new theme out now for Fred Rosser, who was just on the New Japan Resurgence show last night. He is the former Darren Young, who is now with New Japan Pro Wrestling. The song is called No Days Off, featuring Monster Tarver, his old Nexus running mate. Here is a sample of the new track. The song is live on Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, and other platforms. Just search the name John Kiernan or Fred Rosser, No Days Off. So go ahead and give that a listen. We've got some more shout-outs coming up in a little bit. And I also want to mention here that for those of you who have become channel members, and we've picked up a bunch of new channel members on YouTube in the last 10 days or so. First of all, I want to say thank you, and I want to say welcome. But I'm going to be recording a new video Q&A, new video mailbag this week, probably tomorrow, in fact. So get those questions in. If you did not see, channel members only, I put a post up on YouTube in the community section where you can leave your questions. Try to leave just one. We've got over 30 in there so far, but I know there's probably a bunch of people who don't even know the post is up. So if you are not aware of that, go find the post. You can drop a question in there. And my plan is to try to get that recorded either Monday or Tuesday at the latest And any questions I may not be able to get to, we'll get to on the next video. But I want to try to get to as many of them as I can. So go find that post and go leave a question if you are a channel member. I also want to mention, I know last week, a whole bunch of you had issues with Apple podcasts where the show didn't push. It took 24 hours or more in some cases. Not for everybody, but for a lot of people, it took a long time to push out to Apple. And again, that's an Apple issue. It's not an issue on Podbean's end or my end. It's very frustrating when that happens. And it's funny because a few days later, in one of the podcasting newsletters that I subscribe to, there was a whole story about this very issue. A lot of people have been having problems. A lot of publishers have been having problems recently with Apple Podcasts after some changes that they made. So supposedly Apple is aware of it. They're working on it. They said, there's nothing you can do. That's something we've got to work on our end, which of course doesn't fix the issue, but it's one of the reasons why I push the show out to so many platforms. And you hear me mentioning Spotify and Pandora and iHeartRadio. There's so many different ways to get the show. If that happens to you again, I know Apple is the preferred choice for a lot of people. It should be okay this week, I hope. But always remember, if you're still sitting around waiting for the sound off, you don't have to wait on Apple to push that thing out. If it's not out within a few hours, by all means, you've got at least probably a dozen other ways that you can get the shows. So just a word of warning there. If that were to happen again, hop on Spotify. That would be the second choice that I would push on all of you if Apple does not work. Now, this week is going to be a very busy week because we've got a lot of events coming up. I just want to give you a sense of what the podcasting schedule, the streaming schedule is for the Sound Off. Obviously, I'm going to be live after Dynamite on Wednesday, like I am every week, on YouTube. On Thursday, I might be doing a SummerSlam prediction stream on YouTube Thursday night. It's not a guarantee, but that's kind of the working plan right now. Friday night, 100% sure, I will be live on YouTube after AEW Rampage, the first dance in Chicago. It's going to be a big night, and I will be live to cover it all on YouTube as soon as the show goes off the air. Saturday night is SummerSlam, a rare Saturday WWE pay-per-view from Allegiant Stadium in Las Vegas. I will be live on YouTube after SummerSlam for your full coverage, as I am for all of the pay-per-views. And then again on Sunday, you're going to get episode 718 of The Sound Off, and Sunday night, one last time, live, back on YouTube for NXT TakeOver 36 coverage. So you're going to be getting a lot of streaming and a lot of content coming up later on this week, and I hope you will choose me for your coverage. I hope that you will join me for all of the festivities, and I hope that you will also partake in the two contests that are being run by WrestleRumble.com. They are hosting two big contests for SummerSlam this week, starting with the annual SummerSlam Pick'em, with the first place winner walking away $1,000 richer. And $100 goes to the second and third place winners as well. The cutoff time for entry is this Saturday at 8 p.m. Eastern when SummerSlam hits the airwaves. That's the deadline. And some of the prop questions in the contest include, you know, will there be a Money in the Bank cash-in? How will the Sasha Banks against Bianca Belair match end? You know, those types of questions. You guys can answer these. They're easy. Get those entries in. And then, it is my favorite collection, the Winged Eagle collection. First place winner in the Winged Eagle contest receives three Winged Eagle replica belts in black, blue, and white. Second place winner receives the same thing, only in miniature versions. You're going to get mini versions of all three Winged Eagle belts. The cutoff time for entry is the same, Saturday at 8 p.m., and it is only $1 to enter. $1. So quit screwing around and go win. Go win something at WrestleRumble.com. So that way, with the Winged Eagle contest, I can announce your name. I might just pick your name at random next Saturday night to win the whole damn thing. So go to WrestleRumble.com. Another week, sadly, another wrestling death to acknowledge here at the top of the show. Dominic DiNucci passed away on Wednesday at the age of 89. A very big name through the 60s and the 70s. He held the WWWF tag team titles three times with three different partners, and the international tag team titles once with his very good friend Bruno Sammartino, who also held those same belts once upon a time with Batman. I bet you didn't know that. Bruno tagged with Batman, or the Batman, Tony Marino, as champions in 1969, the same year as the Miracle Mets. Actually, Marino passed away a few months ago. He was also pretty high up there. I think he was 90, low 90s, but yeah, he used to... That was back when Batman was a big deal. Adam West played Batman on TV. Called himself the Batman. See, so now you know. Now you know that Bruno Sammartino tagged with the Dark Knight. But DiNucci also trained a lot of names, most notably Mick Foley, who posted a very nice tribute video to him online this week. Shane Douglas. He tagged with Shane Douglas in his final match in 2012. He was 80 years old in 2012. He tagged with Shane Douglas at an independent show in Toronto. 80 years old and going over in his final match. As Hulk Hogan hears that and nods approvingly while stroking his Fu Manchu. Let's not give him any ideas. Although I guess we had our own version of this with Ric Flair just last night. Which brings me to the big events that were taking place last night. Because there is other wrestling in this world. Outside the realm of WWE and AEW. And that was Triple Mania 29. And New Japan's Resurgence Show in Los Angeles. I was at Citi Field last night for the Mets game, Mets against the Dodgers. Of course, we all know how that ended. We don't have to talk about that. But once I got home, I wanted to play catch up with the shows. And on the Triple Mania side, the big match, the big main event last night, was Kenny Omega, who just lost his Impact World Championship the night before on TNT to Christian, which I'm going to talk about in a second. But he was in Mexico to defend his AAA mega title against Andrade El Idolo. And Andrade did not come alone. He arrived, he was accompanied to the ring by his soon-to-be father-in-law, the Nature Boy, Ric Flair, who just got his WWE release, whether you believe he asked for it, as he claims, or whether or not he was basically let go, which I kind of tend to believe that was the case, because why else... Why else give up a very high-paying gig to pretty much do nothing with WWE? But regardless, he was released, and the impression was that it was not a full unconditional release, that he would have some kind of non-compete period where, until he was legally able to do so, he would not be able to go anywhere. So I don't know what his status is as far as that goes. He may have just looked at the situation and said, well, fuck it, what are they going to do to me? We don't know. Maybe he was free and clear. We'll find out, obviously, very soon. I mean, this just happened last night, so we don't have all the details yet. But it was a big surprise to see how quickly he turned up somewhere else. And so he escorted Andrade to the ring for his match. I thought Andrade and Kenny had a very good match with a surprise finish. I thought for sure that Andrade was leaving with that AAA mega title. But Flair got physical, and you knew he wasn't going to be able to help himself, right? 72 years old, he's been on social media recently posting gym selfies and talking about how he'll never retire. So, of course, he got physical. There was a spot near the end where Flair stopped Omega. He got in the ring. He took his jacket off, he got in the ring, and he stopped Omega from hitting Andrade with the mega belt. And then Flair and Andrade took turns chopping Kenny Omega. And Flair knocked him down with a right hand. Flair chopped Conan down because Conan was in Omega's corner. There was no Don Callis. I guess Conan was playing the role of Don Callis here on this night. Flair chops him down. And then he and Andrade put Omega and Conan in dueling figure four leg locks. I think the last time I saw Flair do a spot like this with a family member, I mean, maybe he did with Charlotte once and I just don't remember, but if you recall, when his son Reed, before he passed away, he was first starting to get involved in wrestling, and it might have been his first match. There was some kind of tag match at an independent show, and I recall them doing the same spot where I think Reed and Rick both did stereo figure fours at the same time. So that's kind of what that reminded me of. But there's Ric Flair dropping down, putting the figure four on Conan. This guy so badly wants to get back in the ring for another match. You can just tell. And with a referee distracted, which by the way is a horrible idea and should not happen. I know Dominic DiNucci was still doing it at 80 years old, but we don't need to see Ric Flair back in the ring except to do, a chop here and there is fine. But in an actual match, no, we don't need to see that. But with the referee distracted with Conan, Omega hit Andrade with the belt and then hit the one-winged angel to retain the championship. I thought that, Kevin Dunn's camera cuts were bad in WWE. And we had a little Kevin Dunn appearance on television this week. He popped his head up like the Groundhog on Groundhog Day. I don't know if you noticed that in the segment in the production truck with Seth Rollins on SmackDown Friday night. There he was. He was hiding out behind Seth. Oh, you could see him. We could see him sitting there. But I thought Kevin Dunn's camera cuts in WWE were bad. Triple A made him jealous with the way they shot that match last night. Jesus Christ. This camera cut crap has got to stop. But then I switched over to the New Japan Resurgence show. Didn't have any camera cut issues on this show. From the Torch, in Los Angeles, right outside the LA Memorial Coliseum. What was to have been the site of WrestleMania 7. But who knew that they couldn't sell 100,000 tickets to see Hulk Hogan defeat the evil Iraqi sympathizer. So they moved it into the smaller building. But by all means, please continue to tell the story that it was a bomb threat. From what I saw, I did not see the entire show. Again, I had come from the ball game, and I was trying to watch the AAA stuff. But from what I saw, I did see the match with Moose and Tomohiro Ishii. And I thought that match kicked ass. That was the best Moose match that I have ever seen in my life. He looked great. Ishii never doesn't look great. I mean, Ishii is awesome. So I really enjoyed that match. We had a surprise appearance by Will Ospreay, who suffered a very serious neck injury a number of months ago, and it looked like he was going to be gone for a very long time. It was bad enough that they stripped him. New Japan stripped him of the IWGP Heavyweight Championship only a couple of months after he won the damn thing, or 2.5 months, I think it was. But there he is, and he comes out as this big surprise and takes the microphone, said he's not happy to be there. He just had to come out and make the announcement that he has been medically cleared. And he teased joining the field for this year's G1 Climax, which is starting up next month, before saying that, nah, you know what, I'm not even going to go back to Japan. I think I'm going to hang around here. He says he broke his neck for New Japan, and they stripped him of his IWGP heavyweight title, which is true. That's what they did back on May 20th, is when they made the announcement. He said he gets it, but Jon Moxley had the United States Championship for a year and did not defend it once. And New Japan did not strip it from him, which is true. He makes a good point. Ospreay called the current IWGP champion, Shingo Takagi, a pussy. He said Shingo's an interim champion and Ospreay is the real world champion. He pulled out the IWGP belt and said that he would defend it against anyone, anytime, any place. So we have ourselves a Shawn Michaels Razor Ramon situation now with the dueling IWGP belt. Actually, it reminds me of the Summer of Punk in 2011 and what they did with CM Punk and John Cena, which I'm going to be covering in this week's history segment a little bit later on. That's what this reminds me of. But Ospreay says in the meantime, he's going to focus on New Japan Strong here in the States because they need a big star right now because all they have are those LA Dojo jobbers. And two of those LA Dojo jobbers came out. His words, not mine. Carl Fredericks and Clark Connors, they came out. They were trying to start a fight with Ospreay. TJP was there. He came out to try to calm them down. And Ospreay teased putting TJP over. He was going to, talk him up, but then he turned around and called him a bitch. And TJP got up in Will's face. But just as he and Fredericks and Connors were about to walk away, Ospreay, he said something to them. I didn't pick up on what it was, and then he ran off. So Will Ospreay is back a lot sooner than I think a lot of people expected him to be. And this is interesting now because it looks like they're going to have this angle ongoing for a while where you have Shingo in Japan, who is the official defending IWGP champion. And I got some news on him here in a second, and it doesn't look great. And then you're going to have Ospreay here, I guess, stateside for a while, claiming to be the real champion, defending against, you know, some of the younger talents. And obviously, they're going to build to a unification match at some point. So that's a huge talent for them to get back. You know, New Japan has been ravaged by COVID and the travel restrictions and other restrictions locally in Japan that, you know, in a lot of cases have prevented them from having crowds of more than 3,000 or 5,000 people, if even that. I mean, things were pretty bad over in Japan in the state of emergency over there. There have been other injuries. I don't know what the status of Kota Ibushi is. I had heard that he was very, very sick. He had some bad pneumonia. I hope he's doing better now, but I haven't heard an update on him. So to get Ospreay back is huge for New Japan. Yuji Nagata was the mystery partner for Jon Moxley. He was going to be taking on Doc Gallows and Karl Anderson with some kind of mystery partner. Eddie Kingston would have been too obvious. I thought maybe it would be someone like Sami Callihan, who has had issues and Impact recently with Gallows and Anderson. It turned out to be Nagata, probably somewhere in the middle where I didn't think it would be Nagata, but not exactly a huge surprise. Obviously, the two of them wrestled on Dynamite not that long ago for the IWGP US belt, and we know Moxley has a lot of respect for Nagata, and people there seem to be happy to see him, so he was the mystery man. Nagata also was there to take the losing fall. And after the match, the Gorillas of Destiny showed up to confront Anderson and Gallows, who bailed. Jay White retained his never open weight title over David Finlay. Crowd was far more into Jay White than they were into Finlay. I thought the match was good. I mean, not quite 4 stars good, but it was good. Ishii came out after the match to tease challenging White for the title next, which should be great. And then we had Tanahashi challenging Lance Archer for the IWGP United States Championship in the main event. I thought this was solid stuff with Tanahashi selling most of the way and then making his big comeback and hitting some high fly flows in the end to get the win. This was definitely not any sort of classic New Japan style main event, but with the win, Tanahashi has now held every major championship in New Japan history. He has held the IWGP heavyweight title, the Intercontinental title, which is now retired, the United States Championship, the never open weight title, the tag team championship, 3 times G1 Climax winner, 2 times winner of the New Japan Cup. This man has done it all. And after the match, Jon Moxley, who was in the audience watching this entire thing, Moxley stood up. He looked pissed and angry, and he walked off. And Lance Archer got the mic, and he said, Tanahashi truly is the ace of New Japan. He's glad that Tanahashi brought New Japan to Los Angeles. But he says he wants him to come to AEW. And Archer said he wants his rematch in AEW. He bowed to Tanahashi. They bumped fists out of respect. Tanahashi thanked the crowd. He did his air guitar to end the show. Now that the seed has been planted publicly, this confirms that we will be getting a Tanahashi title defense soon on AEW television. The only question is when. All Out is coming up on September 5th. But the G1 Climax kicks off a few weeks later. I think it's about 3 weeks or 2.5 weeks maybe. I don't know if Tanahashi, offhand, I don't know if it's been announced if he is in the G1 or not. I would expect him to be in it. I'd be kind of surprised if he wasn't. If he is, you still have the COVID quarantines, I think, in Japan. Like when you're traveling back in, you have to quarantine, I think, for either 10 days or 2 weeks. So unless things have changed, I believe that is still in place. That's going to be cutting things a little bit close. So there's always the possibility that even though it makes total sense to try to get him on that All Out show, logistically, if it interferes with the G1 or it interferes with some other New Japan show that he's supposed to be at, he might not be able to be. You know, he might not be able to appear on the All Out card, but it looks like Archer is going to be getting his rematch first before Moxley gets his shot at Tanahashi. And then comes the news this morning, which is what I alluded to a moment ago with Shingo. New Japan made the announcement they have pulled Shingo Takagi, their IWGP champion, and Bushi from today's non-televised Summer Struggle event due to both men coming down with a fever. And they announced that they would both be getting PCR tests and they would be held off the show. They were scheduled for an 8-man tag team main event. They both worked yesterday's event in Japan. There was an event on Saturday night. But they have fevers, and New Japan is not taking any chances with any of this stuff. And so that is the update on Shingo and Bushi, and hopefully both will end up being just fine. AEW Rampage premiered on TNT Friday night, their long-awaited second show. We heard about this second show ever since the day they signed that new contract with TNT at the beginning of last year. We knew there was going to be a second show. We didn't know when. We didn't have a name for it. We didn't know anything about it. And COVID kind of pushed everything back. But we kept hearing about this elusive second show. Meanwhile, the AEW roster has expanded greatly, and there's still more people who haven't debuted yet who are coming in. So the timing for a second show is perfect, because the roster has never been bigger. But it premiered on Friday night with a hot crowd in Pittsburgh and two nice moments with Christian Cage pinning Kenny Omega to win the Impact World title and Fuego del Sol, with tears in his eyes, being surprised by Sammy Guevara after his loss to Miro with an AEW contract. Tony Khan told Sports Illustrated that that was a shoot. Fuego had no idea that was going to happen. Sammy, who he is best friends with in real life, Sammy was the only person that Tony Khan told, and he wanted to make sure that Sammy was the one to deliver the contract to him in the ring. And Fuego del Sol has appeared, you know, a lot of the YouTube stuff and Sammy's vlogs, and he's been on Dark, and he's got like a 1-44 record, legit, in AEW, but, you know, he's become a fan favorite, and, you know, knowing now that it was a genuine moment that, you know, he was not expecting, which is kind of like what happened in NXT when they got Drake Maverick his contract. After he got fired, they brought him back, and then they signed him to a new deal. They did tell him, though, when he got to the building, so it wasn't like when he was out in the arena, he had no idea, but it was a similar thing where they surprised him when he got there with a contract that he wasn't expecting. So that's a nice feel-good moment. I thought the one-hour format for this show worked out perfectly. This is perfect for this show. I liked what little I heard from Mark Henry. He seemed to disappear after the opening match in favor of doing backstage interviews. He's like the Tony Schiavone of Rampage. But without the cool earring, I guess, that Tony has. Chris Jericho, I thought, was insufferable for most of the show. I mean, the energy is appreciated, but not when the energy is sort of breaks the needle and it goes off the charts. I thought he was way over the top. And he's been that way before. I was a fan when he started doing commentary on Dynamite occasionally. I enjoyed the commentary. But now that I've heard this over a period of time, it just felt like he was even more annoying last night. Or Friday night, I should say. He was more annoying than normal. And when you have a booth, and this is what kind of, I think, maybe, you know, made it a little more intolerable, is the fact that you had four people in that, at least for the opening match, you had four people in that booth, and he was just dominating the whole thing. So I thought he was insufferable with the constant shouting, but Tony Khan has said the four-man booth was a one-week deal, which I hope is true, because you do not need four announcers for a one-hour show. I don't think you need four announcers for a two-hour show, unless you want to have two people do hour one and two people do hour two. Just kind of how that's the old Nitro format. When Nitro moved to 2 hours, you had, I think it was it Schiavone and Larry Zbysko, I think, in hour one, and then it was Schiavone and Bobby Heenan, and they threw Mike Tenay in there to talk about wrestling history and stuff for the Luchadors. They had a formula that worked. This formula doesn't work. Hopefully it's one and done. I don't need to be hearing him shouting in my ear every single week. Now, there's no ratings data. I'm very curious how this first show did. I'm going to be more curious how week two does, with all the buzz around the United Center show. But there is no ratings data until Monday. So I have nothing to report on that front. What I can tell you is that there are four Friday Night Dynamite episodes when Dynamite was preempted for an entire month. They had four Dynamites on Friday nights in May and June. And those shows did, in order, 526,000, 462,000, 487,000, this is total audience here, and 552,000 is what the last Friday Night Dynamite did. So I think anything above 500,000, they should consider that a win. Now, as far as Christian against Omega, I thought I enjoyed the match, and I thought the story, though, coming out of it, might be that Omega loses the Impact title, but then goes on to lose the AAA title. And then he is desperate to hold on to the one title that he has left, his most prized possession, the AEW World Championship, which he should hold on to until Hangman Page is ready to come back. But then with him retaining the AAA belt last night, I guess that's not the story. Now, that could have been an Impact call. You know, if they think Christian can make more dates for them than Omega, maybe Omega can't or doesn't want to, you know, going forward. I mean, the guy has been a workhorse all year. At some point, he needs a break. But I think we have to remember that we're talking about a championship that does not belong to AEW. It is an Impact title. It is their property, prop, call it whatever you want. It's an Impact title, not an AEW title. So if they make the call, it's their call to make, right? Ultimately, when it comes to their championship. Another theory is that they simply wanted to go the traditional route, which is giving Christian a big win to show that he can beat Kenny Omega, but then he goes to All Out and he loses. And possibly loses the Impact title right back to him. I mean, who's to say that All Out doesn't become a winner-take-all match? And Kenny Omega doesn't end up back with all the belts in a few weeks. The reality is, we don't know what Tony Khan has planned. And I kind of like that this can go in a number of different directions. I like that I can't predict where they're going with this. It does look like paternity leave is going to take Hangman Page off television for a while, which probably includes the Arthur Ashe show. Otherwise, I would say Arthur Ashe in front of their biggest crowd is a great place to do Omega and Hangman. But honestly, if Hangman's going to be off TV for a while, that's not enough time. It's going to feel rushed. So it doesn't look like that's going to be in the cards. But it needs to be Kenny Omega that he beats when the time comes. And that one-winged angel should be protected. And they've done a great job of protecting that move. It needs to continue to be protected until Hangman Page gets that match where he wins the championship. And in that match, he becomes the first man in AEW to kick out of that move. They at least have to protect that move until we get to the rematch with Hangman and Omega. We had Britt Baker defending the AEW women's title in the main event, since they were in Pittsburgh, so they put her in the main event, against Red Velvet. I thought the match was okay. It really wasn't anything special. But at the end, we had a surprise return for Jamie Hayter. And apparently, I was not alone in thinking for a split second when Jamie Hayter came out, when the match was over. Britt Baker was still attacking Red Velvet. That brought out Chris Statlander. And then this woman, we didn't know it was a woman at first, but this person who is disguised, they have, you know, a hood over their head, comes out to attack Chris Statlander, and it turns out to be Jamie Hayter. And I was not alone in thinking for a split second when she pulled her hood off that it was Becky Lynch. I said, oh boy, Tony Khan has really pulled one out of his ass this time. For about a split second there, I thought it was Becky Lynch, but it was Jamie Hayter, and I can't blame myself for not knowing who it was. Nobody in the building who didn't know who it was can really be held to blame, because this woman looks completely different from the way she looked the last time we saw her on AEW television. She made her Dynamite debut 2 years ago in October, funny enough, against Britt Baker, who it now appears she's going to be aligned with going forward. She looked like a totally different person. If you look at a side-by-side picture of Jamie Hayter 2 years ago and Jamie Hayter now, from that appearance on Friday, I would never know that it was the same human being. It looks like two totally different... She looks good, but it just looks like two totally different people. And you could tell the people in the audience had no idea who it was. When you do a reveal like that, it should be somebody who, when they pull the mask off or they pull the hood off, is instantly recognizable. And that's why when she pulled it off, there really was no reaction. It was a tepid reaction at best, because people just looked at her and went, who's that? Which is never the reaction that you want when you do a mystery reveal like that. Now, the first dance at the United Center in Chicago is this Friday. It will be the debut of CM Punk. They still have not confirmed that, but it will be the debut of CM Punk. Tony Khan also said to Sports Illustrated about that show, he said, and I quote, "I think everyone knows what to expect, and everyone is very excited." And then when asked directly about Punk, he said, "I can't answer that question, but it is a very good question to ask." So there you go. That should set up Punk against Darby Allin at All Out, because there's been a lot of teases for that as well, including an Instagram story that Punk posted that included a quote at the very end that happens to be the same exact quote tattooed on Darby Allin's chest. So the hints are there. If you follow along, the hints are there. But before that, this Wednesday on Dynamite, we have the fifth labor of Jericho, with Chris Jericho taking on MJF. Jericho cannot use the Judas effect. He can't even use his Judas theme song. So the crowd will have to sing it by themselves. We have Jurassic Express challenging the Young Bucks for the AEW Tag Team titles. Sammy Guevara takes on Shawn Spears and also makes some kind of major announcement. And for the first time on TNT in 20 years, since he beat Ric Flair in the final match on the final Nitro, Sting will tag with Darby Allin against the team of 2.0. So we're getting a, for the first time ever, a rare in-ring wrestling appearance on television by Sting. And one other AEW note I want to mention here before we move on to other stories. Max Caster, I covered this last week, of the Acclaimed. He is being sent to sensitivity training, it was reported this week, and he will be off television for a while after his rap a few weeks ago on Dark. There was another report from another source that claimed he was suspended without pay. Apparently that is bullshit. Again, sources are important. Where you get your information and your news from is very important. When I read about what's going on and I look to certain sites and certain sources and shows for news and information, I'm very particular about where I get it from. So when I talk about stuff here on this podcast, you can typically trust that it's coming at least from a source that I find reputable. That is not a source that I find reputable. So it's not a matter of him being suspended without pay, but he is apparently being required to take sensitivity training. He's going to be gone for at least a little while after that whole rap. The controversial rap that wasn't controversial to the people in the building when he said it, and wasn't controversial to the talent in the building who heard it, or to the person who edited the show. But then it became controversial when Twitter deemed it to be. This is horse shit, is what this is. But sadly, this is the world in which we live. So I sure hope that Tony Khan sends the person who edited the show to the same sensitivity training classes that Max Caster now has to attend. Because that person is the one who left it in the show in the first place. A show that was taped 6 days earlier, or five, whatever it was, 5 or 6 days earlier in North Carolina. It didn't air until the following week. Somebody left it in the show, and it wasn't Max, unless Max was at the controls doing the editing as well. It would make little sense to punish him and not the person who let the segment air in the first place. Now, some other miscellaneous notes here to get into. Keith Lee finally opened up this week about why he was off WWE television for the last 6 months. It's been a big mystery about why. We kind of, you know, people are speculating about what it is, because that's just naturally what people do. And the only thing that really made sense to me was that it was something medical, not necessarily COVID-related, but that it was something, you know, medical that was keeping him off television. Everybody was being very hush-hush about it. All of the cryptic tweets were starting to get very old. You know, he would talk about wanting to tell us, but then implying that maybe the company didn't want him to, and he'd have to find some other way to do it, which he now denies. He says that it wasn't that he couldn't say anything, like somebody told him not to. He claims he chose not to, in order to focus on everything that he needed to focus on. But I said, you know, when he's able to tell us, he'll tell us. I just got sick of all the speculation and just figured, okay, well, whatever. Whenever this thing is resolved, he'll let everybody know. But the belief earlier in the year was always that he was going to win the United States Championship in a triple threat match with Lashley and Matt Riddle before WrestleMania. This is when Lashley was still the U.S. champion. They had booked him very dominantly for months. And I said they booked this guy so dominantly that he should be the one challenging for the WWE Championship at WrestleMania. But you've got to get that title off of him. And how do you do that without beating him? Well, triple threat rules in WWE dictate that the champion does not have to be pinned to lose his title. And so that seemed to be the working plan. And then Lee got pulled, and John Morrison ended up replacing him. So all this talk about how, well, maybe he's being punished or they're burying him didn't make any sense. It had no basis in fact. You can talk about questionable booking, especially since he's come back. That's perfectly valid. We could talk about questionable booking for half the fucking roster. But this idea that he was somehow being buried or punished, it didn't make any sense. Because it looked like he was in line for a push, and then it wasn't like he was all of a sudden losing matches on television. He just disappeared. So there had to be a reason, medical, family, that would be what would make the most sense. And now we come to find out that it was, in fact, a medical issue. Scary complications after a COVID diagnosis. He uploaded a video on Thursday, said that he contracted COVID in January and was off television for about 3 weeks. He came back the following month for one TV match against Riddle. And I went back and checked because I was curious which week that was. That was on the February 8th episode of Raw. He wrestled Matt Riddle. And the day after, he got a call informing him that there was something off in his blood work. And he said that some people may experience inflammation in the heart or the lungs with COVID. And in his case, it was from the heart. And that led to some scary times. He was forbidden from training or any kind of activity outside of a light walk because there was the very real risk that doing more than that, he could die. It could put a lot of stress on his heart and he could pass away. You know, I've read about cases of pericarditis and myocarditis with COVID. I had pericarditis a few years ago, as many of you know, and it is not fun. You can go back and listen to that whole story of my experience back on Sound Off 521 after I came out of the hospital. I felt like I was having a heart attack. It mimics the symptoms of a heart attack. I felt like an elephant was sitting on my chest. Now, you know, in my case, they think it was a virus that caused it, but it can have many causes. It affects, what it is it affects the protective sac around the heart. Now, Keith Lee didn't describe feeling like he was having a heart attack and running to the emergency room, but obviously it was serious enough where it was touch and go for him there for a while. And he said it was like this for about 3 or 4 months. And he had several MRIs on his heart. It became a fight against death. And eventually WWE sent him to their medical doctor in Pittsburgh to get looked at. And he says it was to the point where he almost had to undergo genetic testing to see if maybe he had some form of heart disease. But eventually the inflammation subsided on its own. He got medically cleared. And the challenge for him recently has been getting back into ring shape. But it sounds like the worst of it, hopefully, is over. Although COVID can be unpredictable for a lot of people who start feeling better and then all of a sudden they feel like shit again. So hopefully in his case, that's not, you know, what he's going to experience. But he wasn't even sure if he would be able to show up in Dallas when he returned a few weeks ago. He said when he first got COVID, his fiance, Mia Yim, did not have it. And she gave up the chance to be in the Women's Royal Rumble match this year so that she can stay home and take care of him. And it was after that that she also ended up getting COVID. But she refused to leave him alone, and he's not sure without her support if he would even be here right now. There were plans for her to debut on the SmackDown brand, and then nothing ever came from it, which I assume had to do with her staying home to be with him. So he's very lucky to have someone like that. His booking has been questionable since his return, but I will add this caveat, and I am not one to make excuses for dumb booking decisions by WWE. If you listen to this podcast, you will surely never accuse me of that. But I will say this. Even though his booking the last few weeks has been questionable, part of me does wonder if a big part of that has to do with them just kind of testing him to see if he's okay. You know, I saw that he was in a dark match before SmackDown on Friday, even though he's already on Raw. Why would they give him a dark match? You know, he squashed some guy. Why would they give him a dark match on Friday? It's almost like they're trying to let him get some reps in to get back in ring shape, but also just see how he reacts, how his body responds. I mean, if you watch the video, the 5-minute video that he put up, even he sounded unsure of what the future may hold as far as his short-term health is concerned. So it's almost like, let's ease this guy back into the rotation. Let's see if he responds well. And if his body holds up and he seems to be doing better, then we can start to work him back into actual storylines. But why put him back in a big storyline if, you know, in 2 weeks there might be some kind of issue that requires us to take him off TV again? But it's great that he's healthy. Or healthier. I'm happy to hear that. It's very scary when you're dealing with any kind of heart issue. If he can stay healthy, I maintain that he can be a major player on either show, Raw or SmackDown, but his health has to come first. Without your health, you have nothing. Doesn't matter what spot you're in, it doesn't matter how much money you have in the bank, when you get sick, you would give anything to be healthy again. You would give it all away to be healthy and feel better again. That is more important than anything Vince McMahon could ever give him. 2 weeks ago, Bray Wyatt was released by WWE, and people were speculating about his mental health, something that I took pains not to do on this podcast because I didn't fully trust those initial reports that claimed he was having a tough time dealing with Brody Lee's death and he asked for time off. I mean, I believe that, you know, Brody Lee's death hit him very hard, but the fact that that had something to do with him wanting time off television, it just... The so-called source that that came from is not a legitimate source of information, and I will not mention that person's name. And as it turned out, surprise, surprise, his absence from television had nothing at all to do with that. According to Fightful, who reached out to sources connected to Wyatt, they confirmed his absence had nothing to do with, quote, falsely reported mental health issues. They said he is 100% healthy and he is able to wrestle. During his time off, he was working on adding creative elements to his character, and The Fiend was originally slated to return this past Monday night on Raw from Orlando. That had been the working plan. And in addition, he also had family engagements already scheduled in May and June that would have taken him off TV anyway. So there were plans for his return, and he would have been back last Monday had they not fired him. The million-dollar question is why did they decide to change the finish? I still would love to have an answer to this. Why did they decide to change the finish at the last minute, the weekend of, to his WrestleMania match with Randy Orton if he wasn't hurt and he didn't ask for time off? When did Vince McMahon make that call? And why? That is what the curious part of my brain would love to know. Because it seems like that was when he made the call to make Alexa Bliss the new Fiend. And outside of that one Firefly Funhouse on Raw the next night, we never saw Bray Wyatt again. I look at their roster, and I can name probably a dozen or more people that the company will never really make any money with. Yet they decided to get rid of Bray Wyatt for what was said to be budget cuts. I just don't understand it. And Andrew Zarian of the Matt Men podcast previously reported that there would be a Queen of the Ring tournament for the first time this fall, and that the finals would be held at the next WWE show in Saudi Arabia. Sweet Saudi money, which is tentatively scheduled for October 21st. But it looks like that won't be the only tournament final held that night. He is also reporting that WWE is reviving the King of the Ring, which was last held 2 years ago when Baron Corbin won. And the finals will also be taking place at Sweet Saudi Money 6. Xavier Woods is ready. We know that. He's been waiting for this moment his entire life. I'd love to see him get the shot. I want to see him in the tournament. I want to see him go all the way to the finals, and then I want to see him lose. King of the Ring is a heel gimmick anyway. But I'm sure he is waiting very patiently for the official announcement and for his qualifying match. But I think so many people at this point, especially if you follow him on social media, it's in his Twitter name, Future King of the Ring. If you follow him on social media, if you are a fan of his Up Up Down Down channel, which has a lot of subscribers, there are a lot of people who are well aware of his love and infatuation with the King of the Ring. So I definitely would like to see them incorporate that into a story on TV. If they don't, it is a huge missed opportunity. I'm sure Vince McMahon knows nothing of this, though, so it's going to require either Woods himself or one of the writers to tell Vince McMahon about this. I doubt he gives a shit. But if he's not part of this tournament in some way, then there is no justice. A few more shout-outs here from our great supporters this week. I want to say thank you to New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, Sherrod Big Daddy Boyd, I Run These Streets, Ivan Para, the Orlando Commando, Christopher Thompson, Caleb Showtime Lindley, first-time donator, listening since 2014, so my thanks to Caleb, the Alabama Assassin, Chris Young, and check out the Suplex City Limits podcast. It's a fun comedy pro wrestling podcast. Join them for the Suplex City Limits Wake and Bake Show live every Saturday at noon on YouTube. That's noon Eastern Time, and on demand everywhere podcasts are found by searching Suplex City Limits. And finally, Philip and his wife. You've heard me mention them the last several weeks. I'm going to mention them again here because they run a YouTube channel called My Slotty Obsession. And I know some of you now have become obsessed with watching them, where they post videos of their high-limit slot play from various casinos all throughout the United States. All of their videos are under 3 minutes. It's a quick, easy watch, nothing fancy. Just some high-limit slot play. Just type My Slotty Obsession into the search bar on YouTube. Be sure to like and subscribe. They post new videos daily. I hope that Philip and his wife are doing well. Let's talk about Raw. I was doing well until we decided here that it was time to move on to Monday Night Raw. Randy Orton was back from his mysterious 7-week absence. He wanted nothing to do with Matt Riddle. And AJ Styles and Omos came out. That set up the Orton-Styles main event later in the show. Baron Corbin. Poor Baron Corbin. He came to Raw all the way from SmackDown because he's broke. And Jinder Mahal offered him money to wrestle Drew McIntyre. In their match, as Drew was setting up for the Claymore kick, Corbin was on his, not even his knees, I think he was laying on the mat looking up. He was begging Drew not to do it. And when Drew grabbed the microphone and he knelt down and he called Corbin pathetic, Corbin said, he mouthed the words, "I know." That made me laugh. That got a laugh out of me. And the Corbin stuff has become the most amusing parts of these shows. McIntyre, of course, got the win. He kept Jinder and his goon squad at bay with his mighty sword. You know, the Berserker once tried to kill the Undertaker with a sword. Almost got him, too. Put the sword right through the mat. You would think that this company would ban such a deadly weapon from being used in a threatening manner, but I guess they don't care. The sword stuff is every bit as ridiculous as having the Bludgeon Brothers carry those giant mallets to the ring. It's, you have moments where when Drew is holding it and posing with it, it's cool, but the idea of him threatening to decapitate people with this or impale them with this sword is just ridiculous. But then again, there's a lot of ridiculous shit on there. That's not even the most ridiculous thing that happened on this show on Monday. Jeff Hardy was back for the first time since his COVID diagnosis. He lost to Karrion Kross. They should have done this on night one. Kross never should have lost in the first place. This does not excuse that. But at least he won. It's a moral victory. And they absolutely piped in crowd jeers at the end of this when he attacked Hardy when the match was over. And they did it again in the next match when Doudrop saved Eva Marie from an attack by Alexa Bliss. They don't even trust their own audience. They have to continue to manipulate their reactions. At least don't make it so noticeable. Speaking of Doudrop, she had a match with Alexa Bliss that ended with them cutting to a CGI shot on screen of Lily the doll, who was at ringside, because Alexa brings Lily to the ring and puts her in the corner. Lily, at one point here, ended up on top of the ring post in one of the corners of the ring. And Doudrop turns around at one point to look over at Lily, and they cut to a shot, a CGI shot of the doll's face. And the doll winks. It winked at Doudrop, which scared her, and Alexa Bliss rolled her up for the win. Garbage is what this was. Hot garbage. We got another match between Damian Priest and John Morrison. And for, I swear to God, for a second I thought I had accidentally started playing last week's DVR recording. Because, you know, I'll flip to other channels or do other things. When I turned around and I saw that it was Damian Priest in the ring with John Morrison, I thought, because I don't delete the recordings right away, I thought I was watching a DVR recording of Raw from the week prior. This is ridiculous. This guy just cannot quit Miz and Morrison. And after Priest won, I mean, at least he's winning, but for God's sakes, at this point, what does it even matter? Him beating Miz and Morrison, what does it do for him at this point? After he won, he challenged Sheamus to a U.S. title match at SummerSlam, which Sheamus accepted. That should be good. This? I'm done with this. Enough. Move on. Before the Rhea Ripley match with Nikki Ash, we got promos in the back from each of them. First came Rhea, who said, now Rhea Ripley, man, Rhea Ripley used to be cool. You know, when she was in NXT, she just had that cool factor about her. And here I watch her on Raw, and she's being interviewed in the back, and she says, as a former Raw Women's Champion, I understand the balance between light and dark that is needed to hold on to that title. Ugh. Then we go to Nikki Ash, who acknowledged that her dream could become a nightmare tonight, but I'll be okay, she said, because I've got my nightlight in the form of my spirit and my I'm sorry. Almost threw up a little bit in my mouth. I'll be okay. Let me just take a sip of water here. Ugh. Taste some of that burger from the ball game last night. That's what these segments do to me. That's what this dialogue does to me. It makes me dry heave. One of these days it won't be so dry. This dialogue is shit. Whoever writes this stuff I know Nikki came up with this gimmick on her own. I hope she's not writing her own stuff because it's fucking atrocious. We had an Elias video package. He was outside somewhere. There was a fire in front of him. And he took the guitar and he threw it into the fire. Said WWE stood for Walk with Elias, but Elias is dead. Now, on the one hand, I'm all for a refresh and some character development for this guy because there hasn't been any in years. On the other hand, if I'm Elias, I'm very nervous right now that my name winds up on the next list of cuts. Or maybe he's not nervous. Maybe he's looking forward to it. But usually people don't like losing their job. If I'm him, I'm very nervous right now. Now that they have seemingly taken my gimmick away from me, and we'll see what their plans are for him. Maybe they give him a totally new one. But, you know, Elias was the guy who came out with the guitar and he played songs. And now that they have seemingly taken that away from him, I'm just saying I would be scared if I was him for my future. And Randy Orton pinned AJ Styles, hitting an RKO when AJ went for the phenomenal forearm. After the match, Riddle wanted a hug from Orton. He refused. But then he reconsidered and he gave him a hug anyway, a big pop from the crowd. And of course, the guy's whole gimmick is that he's a snake that can't be trusted. Orton laid him out with an RKO, which prompted Byron Saxton to yell, "I think they're back together." Of course they're back together. It would have been booking malpractice to break them up before they even challenged for the tag team title. They haven't even had a match yet for the tag team titles, let alone won them, which they should. At SummerSlam. But now that we got Raw out of the way, I want to talk about something that actually matters. I want to talk to you guys about the internet. Something that we all take for granted, but it's also something we use every single day of our lives. This show that you're listening to right now would not be possible were it not for the internet. Our lives are on there. We post photos and videos, which is why you need to be thinking about your privacy. And for that, you should be using ExpressVPN. Using the internet without ExpressVPN, it's like driving a car without insurance. Why would you do that? Why would you ever want to take that risk? Anytime you connect to a network that's not encrypted, whether you're at home or on the road somewhere, like a hotel or an airport, any hacker on that network can gain access to your personal data, like passwords and financial records. You don't have to be the guy from Mr. Robot to hack someone. All you really need is some cheap hardware. A child could do it. How important is your data to you? I'm willing to bet it's pretty damn important. I know it is to me. Look at ExpressVPN as a form of online insurance. It creates a secure, encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet, ensuring that hackers cannot steal your data. I also find it to be very simple. I just fire up the app, I click one button, and I know I'm protected. And it doesn't matter what device I'm using. It could be my laptop, my smartphone, my tablet, if I had one. It works across all of these different devices. It's that kind of protection that I like the most about ExpressVPN. It's invaluable. You cannot put a price on protecting your information. You just can't. That's why it's so important to me, just knowing that it's in the background doing its job. It takes the stress out of using the internet for me. Now it's your turn. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/solomonster. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster. Use that link and you can get an extra 3 months free. expressvpn.com/solomonster. SmackDown on Friday night brought John Cena together in the ring face-to-face with Roman Reigns. This was the big face-to-face promo that we've been waiting for as we head on into SummerSlam and the big main event for the Universal Championship. And Reigns told Cena not to waste his time. Cena said he wouldn't waste his time, but he would wait until SummerSlam to embarrass him on the biggest stage of them all. I guess SummerSlam now is the biggest stage of that. Well, how big does that make the WrestleMania stage? If the SummerSlam stage is the biggest stage of them all, then the WrestleMania stage must be gigantic. Cena note, well, they should be calling this, maybe this is WrestleMania SummerSlam. Maybe that's what it is. We had WrestleMania Backlash, now we have WrestleMania SummerSlam, so technically then it would be the grandest stage of all. Then it would make sense. But Cena noted that if he wins the championship, that would make him a 17-time world champion and the most decorated champion of all time. Very happy finally to see them mentioning this. Been waiting for this. Reigns said that he's not like Cena. He wouldn't bury his opponent and go out there and beat him. Reigns said he respects Cena. He said Cena is arguably the greatest of all time. Reigns says he'll be just proud as could be to say that he beat John Cena. He said Cena juggles Hollywood and WWE. He said they don't even have enough time to promote all of his movies. How many movies are you in right now? I think he's in like 3 or 4 different movies right now. And he said Cena is good enough to face the Tribal Chief. He's even good enough maybe to win the WWE Championship. But he's not good enough to win the Universal title. He said 20 plus years of missionary position might have been good enough for Cena, but it clearly was not good enough for Nikki Bella. I'm going to smash you. I'm going to retain this title. I'm going to pack you onto a private jet, and I'm going to send you back to Hollywood. And he told the fans, enjoy it, because this might be the last time that you people see John Cena. And then Reigns looked at him and said, take it home, kid. And you could see the change on Cena's face after Roman hit him with that Nikki Bella line. He gets that smirk. He's pacing back and forth. You know, he's going over the potential comebacks and the potential burns in his head while Roman is still talking. Cena said Reigns has been protected. And he also poked fun at the giant bars of soap that you have for teeth. He said Reigns almost ruined Seth Rollins and he ran Dean Ambrose out of WWE, which got a great reaction from the crowd. Cena said Reigns has had the protection of the system and still it is not working. He said Paul Heyman knows better than anybody how much punishment he can take. John Cena said he built Suplex City. He said all he has to do is hang in there and all he needs is 1, 2, 3. And then Roman Reigns becomes the answer to a trivia question. Who did John Cena beat to become a 17-time champion? Cena said he would take the title, he would jump the barricade, he would leave the stadium as fast as he could. He said he might even blow Roman a kiss goodbye, which is an obvious callback to CM Punk and Money in the Bank. Cena, by the way, yesterday, on his Instagram. Because Cena has a very weird Instagram. He doesn't post any text, he just puts a seemingly random photo up. And people are left to interpret what it means and why he posts it. Well, yesterday, the picture he posted was CM Punk sitting on the barricade right after he won the WWE title of Money in the Bank in 2011, blowing a kiss to Vince McMahon. And Cena said that at SummerSlam, the champ is gone. 1, 2, 3. This was not nearly as good as their last exchange a few years ago on Raw, although Roman was light years better than he was back then. You can tell he's a lot more comfortable in the heel role now. Cena, we know, could hang with anybody on the mic. I thought Cena, for the most part, mopped the floor with The Rock when they went toe-to-toe a few years ago. You know, with The Rock, we all know how great The Rock is, but, you know, The Rock can, you know, have a tendency to rely on some of the toilet humor a little too much. You know, popcorn farts and such. And Cena, I thought, was really hitting him hard and was winning a lot of the promo battles. And, you know, when he came out doing the rapping stuff, you know, going Thuganomics a few years ago. So we know that Cena can hang with the best of it. We know what he's capable of on the mic. This wasn't even his best work. But I like that they finally had Cena mention title number 17 after brushing it off when he first came back. It's like, that has to play into this storyline here. To a lot of people, that's a big deal. There's a lot of people who may not want to see him win title number 17. And there's a lot of people who do. That has to play into every near fall in that match. It's part of the drama of the match. It has to be part of the story of the match. So I was very happy to see him bring it up on television this week. Shinsuke Nakamura, who is now officially King Nakamura, at least until they bring back the King of the Ring in a couple of months, he pinned Apollo Crews to become a 2-time Intercontinental Champion, pinned him clean with the Kinshasa. After so long as a background player, the act with Rick Boogs and Pat McAfee as well. Pat McAfee, the way he gets into the Nakamura entrances, he stands up on the announce desk, he dances around. All of this has helped breathe new life into Nakamura, and it's gotten over. The fans are into it. But it is a sad end for Apollo Crews as champion. He couldn't win a match on television to save his life for months. This will go down as a very forgettable reign, but I hope it is not the end of him being featured on TV. He deserves better than just being shuffled to the back of the line. Now, I wish this would have been at SummerSlam, but they reportedly have a hard stop to the show on Saturday to allow people to attend the Pacquiao fight that night. I saw that Pacquiao lost his opponent to an eye injury, so they've slotted a new name in there that I've never heard of before for him to fight. But WWE has promised the show will end on time so that people who have tickets to the fight can make it over to the other venue. So they can't go overtime. There's not going to be any kind of overtime period for SummerSlam this year. And they already have a full card. I don't have it in front of me, but they have every bit of, I think, 7 or 8 matches. You know, including ones that haven't even been announced yet. Because you have to figure it's going to be Orton and Riddle against AJ and Omos. So they've got a full card. And they can't go over. So this match got more time on television than it probably would have been given at SummerSlam anyway. The Street Profits got a win over the Alpha Academy. I really want to see Gable and Otis built up as tag team title contenders. And there's still time to do that, especially since right now we already have heel champions in the Usos. I'm not convinced that they're dropping those titles at SummerSlam, so they're probably going to get a longer reign. As long as Gable and Otis come out of this looking strong, when I say come out of this, they've been feuding with the Street Profits now for a little while. As long as they come out of this looking strong, I want to see them get a run with those silver dollar belts at some point. We had Seth Rollins in the production truck yelling at everybody, and we got a glimpse of Kevin Dunn. A wild Kevin Dunn appeared. And at that very moment that I laid eyes upon him, I could feel a cold chill upon my neck, like I was in the presence of an evil spirit. Rollins came to the ring. He showed a video package comparing his career with Edge's and how Edge was part of a lame group like The Brood while he debuted as part of a dominant faction called The Shield. Edge was the first man to cash in Money in the Bank, but Rollins topped him with his cash in at WrestleMania. Edge won the Royal Rumble 10 years apart, but both times he went on to WrestleMania, the first time against Chris Jericho and again this year, and he failed to win the championship. Meanwhile, Rollins, he won the Royal Rumble in 2019, and he went on to WrestleMania to slay the beast and become the Universal Champion. And this time, he said, unlike in 2014, I will not hesitate to end Edge's career. Edge wasn't there. This was just the Rollins show here in this segment. I like the video comparison. I thought this was good. This was good to build to their match at SummerSlam. Rey and Dominic, they beat Dolph Ziggler and Bobby Roode, but they have been dropping little hints of trouble brewing between father and son, with Rey warning him, you gotta stay focused. You're making mistakes. You're making rookie mistakes. We got more sad Baron Corbin, who talked about being near bankruptcy, and the fans cheered. These fucking people, they cheered. This man is suffering. This man has never been lower in his life, and these people cheer. He said this was going to be the last time that he would beg the fans for money, and he wanted each of them to give him $1,000. He even had one of those credit card scanner accessories attached to his smartphone. Kevin Owens interrupted. He agreed to pay Corbin $1,000 if he beats Owens in a match. But if Owens wins, Corbin has to stop begging the fans for money. And Owens beat him with a sunset flip off the rope, so Corbin can no longer beg for money. But then I'm thinking, or else what? Right? Like, that was the stipulation. Corbin lost. So what? What does he have to lose if he refuses to adhere to the stipulation? If WWE isn't paying him, which is what I get from this storyline. Somehow he's showing up on television every week, he's working, but he's not getting paid. He's bankrupt, he's destitute. So what is he worried about? He's going to get fined? He doesn't have the money anyway. They're already not paying him. Kayla went to interview Corbin in the back when he came back through the curtain. And before he could say a word, he looked ahead and he spotted Big E. And he runs over to Big E. He kind of shoves him away. He grabs the briefcase. He grabs Big E's Money in the Bank briefcase that was sitting on a table. And he runs off with it, celebrating like he just found the winning lottery ticket. So now Baron Corbin is Mr. Money in the Bank based on what we'll call the John Cena rule. They already established on television a few weeks ago that if you have a contract, even if it's intended for you, if somebody else swoops in and signs it before you do, they get your spot. Why should this be any different? Right? Why should this be any different? So now Corbin has the briefcase, and I guess they could have a match at SummerSlam for it. What else is Big E going to do? If he doesn't cash in, what else is Big E? Big E doesn't have a match on the show. They could have a match for the briefcase between Corbin and Big E. You know, and I know none of this makes any sense, but this is the most entertaining storyline that they have right now on Raw or SmackDown. The most entertaining storyline, for my money, on WWE television at this very moment. And it involves Baron Corbin. That is some Vince McMahon wizardry right there. That he got me to admit that Baron Corbin is the most entertaining thing on either of his shows. And I don't think that speaks very highly to Vince McMahon's shows. But here we are. Here we are. I think it's entertaining. And then we had a standard WWE contract signing to end the show with Sasha Banks and Bianca Belair making their match official for SummerSlam. Sasha called out Carmella and Zelina Vega as witnesses to back her up. As soon as Bianca signed the contract, all hell broke loose. She fought off Carmella and Zelina. Sasha gave her a backstabber, wrapped her own braid around her face and around her mouth, and pulled back for the bank statement to end the show. Let it be known that Toni Storm debuted on SmackDown 3 weeks ago. She has not appeared nor been mentioned since. And I get that they're building to SummerSlam. They have a pay-per-view now in less than a week, and she is not on the card, so the focus has to be on all of these other matches. But if that is the reason why she is not on this show, and we don't know the reason that she is not on this show, is she hurt? Is there a personal issue? Is there a visa issue? We don't know, because she just vanished and nobody has said a word. Logically, I'm willing to bet that it has to do with the fact that she's not on the SummerSlam card and so we don't have television time for her right now. If that is the case, then why introduce her last month and not wait until after SummerSlam if you knew that she wasn't going to be on the SummerSlam card? Why not just wait until after the pay-per-view? Why ask why? Why do I even ask these questions since nobody ever gives me a logical straight answer? Why do I ask such logical questions when I know that I'm not going to get an answer? I don't know, but I'll continue to ask these questions because I can't help myself. I'm trying to apply logic to an illogical situation. Now, in this week's NXT drama update, I want to read you some passages from this week's Observer, because this is what Meltzer was reporting this week as a follow-up to all of the NXT releases and the situation as it currently stands currently in NXT. And it's a fucking mess. It says, even though these were NXT releases, it was Vince McMahon, Bruce Pritchard, and John Laurinaitis who decided who would be cut. Those in NXT said that not only did Paul Levesque nor Shawn Michaels have a say in the cuts, they weren't even aware of them until after Laurinaitis started calling the talent. Now think about that. You talk about Triple H being left out of the loop, right? It's his brand. It's his vision for the brand, and he's the one running the day-to-day of NXT and forming the relationships and coming up with the creative for this talent. They didn't even consult him in advance or give him a heads up that there were cuts coming or who the cuts were going to be. He's got to book television week to week. He's got a takeover special coming up. And they wouldn't even give him the courtesy of letting him know in advance, hey, we're about to cut so-and-so. And you don't think there aren't people in this company that don't have it out for Triple H? Meltzer said Levesque had been thought to be untouchable, but in failing to stop AEW's rise and eventually losing the war, it gave both his detractors and those who felt he would replace them the obvious ammunition. I hear that line, and the first name that comes to mind is Kevin Dunn. We've heard about this for years. That Triple H and Stephanie, when and if the day ever came that Kevin Dunn, or not Kevin Dunn, but Vince McMahon stepped aside, if they took over in some way, Kevin Dunn would be one of the first people out the door. That they wanted him out and replace him with somebody that they handpicked themselves. Kevin Dunn has to know that. Kevin Dunn is a Vince McMahon guy. He's worked for this company now for so many years. He's worked under the thumb of Vince McMahon. He's a Vince McMahon guy. He's not a Triple H guy. I hear something like that. Forces, internal forces in the company who would love to just conspire almost against Triple H because they see him as a threat to their own position, and that's the first name I thought of. Because Kevin Dunn is not just the one who produces the show. He's in a very powerful position, very influential and powerful position in that company. Meltzer said the idea is that Levesque is in control and his vision for the product failed to attract younger viewers. Partially, if not largely, because of going against AEW, NXT was the oldest skewing wrestling show among the major national shows, which is true. I would read about that every week when I would look at the demos and stuff, and it was unbelievable. What was carrying NXT for so long was the 50 and over crowd. I don't know if that's still the case today, but for the longest time, it was the oldest skewing wrestling show on television, even more so than Raw. And the average median age of the Raw viewer has gone up as well over the years. But he says, within both the television and the wrestling business, it was considered a given that with the WWE backing, it would eventually dominate Wednesday. And the opposite happened. The idea was that at NXT, originally it was set up and funded to be a developmental project, and it ended up being filled with 5'8" guys who were past the age of 30, and the mentality of Vince McMahon is that those people cannot be main roster stars. The idea is they wanted bigger people and more characters developed. One person in the company noted that the mindset is that when WWE would sign independent talent, they would first have to beat the independent out of them when it came to their style in the ring, but then when they made it to the main roster, they would have to beat the NXT out of them. This toxicity led to Karrion Kross, the NXT champion, losing twice on Raw, while NXT was building him as an unstoppable monster, having to run through the roster for a showdown with Samoa Joe. Those internally said that when Bronson Reed got his tryout match in recent weeks, Vince McMahon decided against him and felt that due to the fact that if he's not going to be on the main roster, then what is the point of keeping him? So think about that. Bronson Reed, you know, we sit around, and I'm sure I'm not the only one who talks about this stuff on their show who has, you know, made comments in a jokey, but not really a jokey way about whenever we hear about a call-up or a dark match before SmackDown, it's like, well, this is the beginning of the end. There's a reason. There's a reason why we talk like this. There's a reason why I make those kinds of comments. And I did the same thing when I saw that Bronson Reed was going to be getting a tryout match before SmackDown. And now we find out that he had his match and Vince McMahon took one look at the guy and said, I don't see it. And then he decided, well, if I don't see it and we're not going to put him on TV, then what's the point of keeping him around? Meanwhile, there were people in the company who had come up with creative plans for him with the idea that he might be called up. But apparently the final call is made by the final boss, and we know who the final boss is. If Vince McMahon doesn't like you, it doesn't matter if the writers like you. It doesn't matter if, you know, one of the other people underneath him happens to like you. If he doesn't buy in, if there's no buy-in from the boss, then you're done. You're toast. You're finished. And just like that, Bronson Reed's career in WWE came to an end. And it was the same mentality, he says, with people like Mercedes Martinez and other people. If these people are not people we're going to call up to the main roster, then why are they here in the first place? Let's just get rid of them all. Let's just clean house. Meanwhile, I mentioned the Karrion Kross thing, right? And how this toxicity behind the scenes kind of bled over into what we saw with him on television. Well, Dakota Kai, at the beginning of NXT this week, had a match against Saray, who was subbing for Ember Moon, who is said to be out with an injury that I believe is a minor injury. I don't think it's anything that's going to keep her out for too long. But they slotted her in Ember Moon's place, and Dakota Kai beat her. That's Saray's first loss since she debuted. But Dakota Kai is the one who's going to be challenging Raquel Gonzalez next weekend for the title, so no problem. But Dakota Kai had a dark match, not even a dark match, it aired on Main Event. They brought her in to tape a Main Event match last week against Aaliyah. And Dakota Kai comes, and I watched it. I watched the match, I watched the entrance. Dakota Kai comes out, and she is playing the role of smiling babyface, which is the opposite of the role that she's playing at this very moment on NXT television, which, by the way, airs on USA Network every week. This is not a show that is being hidden away on Peacock. This is a two-hour USA Network show that airs on the same network that airs Monday Night Raw. People watch this show. And here on Main Event, she comes out playing a totally different character. And not only that, but she lost. She lost to Aaliyah, who I would be shocked to find out has won more than five matches in the 6 years that she has been with NXT. Not only did they switch her from heel to babyface and beat her, before she challenges for the women's title next Sunday, she lost to one of the worst-looking DDTs that I have ever seen in my life. So when I say that the higher-ups in this company have no respect for NXT, for the audience that watches NXT, I will point you to shit like this. And this is only one example of it. Also on the show on Tuesday, we had a series of comedy skits involving Johnny Gargano, Candice LeRae, Dexter Lumis, and Indy Hartwell, who were preparing to go on their first date together. And Johnny and Candice were like her parents. You know, Dexter rings the doorbell. He's got these dead or dying black flowers in his hand, and Johnny's playing the role of concerned dad, and they go on this covert operation following them to the Italian restaurant that they were eating at. It was all played up for comedy. I mean, it's fine. I mean, I'm amused by the whole Indy Dexter thing. I don't know how this pays off in the end. I still feel like at some point she's going to get him to speak and say his first words. He's still the mute who doesn't say anything. He just kind of stares at you. That can't go on for much longer. At some point, the guy has to speak. There's got to be some kind of evolution of this character at some point. But Johnny Gargano and Candice LeRae made an announcement this week on social media that they are expecting their first child in February. Baby wrestling, they said, is due in February of 2022. So congrats to the happy couple. Candice has said that she plans to stick around on TV as long as she is physically able to do so. So she is not going away just yet. But she will not be wrestling. Ilya Dragunov made his debut on NXT proper. He came out for a promo at the COVID Coliseum. He was interrupted by Pete Dunne, which set up the main event on this show. Ted DiBiase was back for an in-ring segment after LA Knight's squash win. LA Knight was still out there chastising his butler, Cameron Grimes, when DiBiase came out. This was not good. This was not a good segment. DiBiase looked lost. Like he forgot his lines. I guarantee you he forgot his lines. He was repeating himself over and over while he was trying to remember exactly what it was that he was supposed to say. And it's not like they gave him a lot to say in the first place, but clearly he got lost and forgot his lines. It was a very, very rough segment here. But LA Knight said, even though I've beaten Cameron Grimes twice, I'd face him a third time, sure. And I'll put my $1 million belt on the line at TakeOver this Sunday. But this time, when I win, Ted DiBiase, you have to become my new butler. So that is the stipulation for the match between LA Knight and Cameron Grimes next Sunday at TakeOver. Cameron Grimes is going to win the $1 million championship. But if he doesn't, Ted DiBiase has to become his new butler. We had we'll call it a spotlight match, put the shine on Gigi Dolin, who seems to be getting her first real push here in NXT. She came out with JC Jane in her corner. And she got a squash win with a pretty cool-looking finish. It was like an abdominal stretch where she drove her opponent down into the mat. William Regal moderated a face-off in the ring between Adam Cole and Kyle O'Reilly, where they each got to pick their stipulations for their 2 out of 3 falls match at TakeOver 36. O'Reilly went with a straight wrestling match, because beating Adam Cole in a regular match, he said, would hurt his ego more than any chair shot ever would. Adam Cole picked Street Fight for the second fall, and then they ended up having a pull-apart brawl. Regal said the third and deciding fall, if necessary, would be a steel cage match. I am so ready for this feud to be over. As much as I am ready to see Adam Cole take his services right out of this company. I am ready for Adam Cole to make his choice, and hopefully the choice that he makes on his future is one that takes him right out of WWE. That is what I am hoping for. Odyssey Jones beat Trey Baxter in a semifinal match in the breakout tournament. Jones is a very charismatic guy. You take that plus his size, I can see why they've had him up for dark matches before SmackDown. I think he's the kind of guy Vince McMahon would want to fast track to the main roster. I don't think that's a smart move, because clearly he's still very green. He could benefit from staying down in NXT for a while and dominating down there and then being called up. But we've seen people get called up long before they really should be. I hope that doesn't happen with him. I think they definitely have something in this guy, but he needs more experience. And when you call somebody up before they're ready, sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't. But why not give the guy the best chance to succeed? Best thing for him, I think, would be to stay right where he is. I could see him as NXT champion one day. And Pete Dunne beat Ilya Dragunov in a very good main event. I'm not a fan of beating Dragunov in his first NXT match a week before he challenges for the UK championship. That I didn't like. There was interference. There was a distraction from Walter. His theme music played. Walter walked out near the finish. And so that led ultimately to Dragunov's downfall. But even still, he should not have lost. But they're keeping Pete Dunne strong, continuing to keep him strong, as they have now for many, many weeks. And I believe it is for an NXT Championship match with Samoa Joe, after Joe beats Karrion Kross. So that was NXT. Yeah, I feel like I'm watching The Walking Dead now when I watch this show. I'm waiting for like Johnny Ace to come take a bite out of this guy's neck or take a bite out of this woman's arm. But there are things to enjoy on this show. It just feels so pointless to get invested in any of it.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, we go back 44 years ago this week. On August 10th, 1977, just one day shy of his 24th birthday, Terry Bollea, going by the name Hulk Hogan, made his in-ring wrestling debut in Florida against Brian Blair. It was Hogan's very first match. Blair had only been in wrestling for about 6 weeks by this point himself. They were booked to go to a 15-minute time limit draw. And they were having what they thought was a great match. The people were really into it. The boys are all out by the curtain watching them. And they're heading for what they think are the final few moments of the match when all of a sudden they hear the ring announcer go, 15 minutes down, 15 minutes remaining. So unbeknownst to the two of them, the other wrestlers played a rib on them and they had the ring announcer change it from a 15-minute match to a 30-minute match. And they were already exhausted by the 15-minute mark. Blair said that by the time it was over, it was the worst match that he had ever had. 41 years ago this week, on August 9th, 1980, the WWF hosted its third and final showdown at Shea Event from the former home of the New York Mets and the New York Jets, Shea Stadium in Flushing, Queens, before what was then the third largest pro wrestling audience in U.S. history. They had over 36,000 fans in the stadium. The first showdown at Shea was held in 1972, the second one in 1976, which included a closed-circuit airing from Tokyo of the famous boxer versus wrestler match between Muhammad Ali and Antonio Inoki. Andre the Giant also wrestled Chuck Wepner that night in Shea in another boxer against wrestler match. But on this night, the card included Antonio Inoki defeating Larry Sharp, Tatsumi Fujinami retaining his WWF Junior Heavyweight title over Chavo Guerrero, Chavo Classic. Bob Backlund and Pedro Morales beat the Wild Samoans in a 2-out-of-3 falls match to win the WWF Tag Team titles, which they were forced to vacate the next day due to a one-person, one-belt rule they had at the time, which meant that Backlund, who was the WWF champion, could not hold any other title. Which begs the question why this was a title match in the first place. Why not just make this a non-title match? I don't really know the answer. Andre the Giant defeated Hulk Hogan back when the roles were reversed and Hogan was the heel, Andre was the babyface. And in the main event, Bruno Sammartino defeated Larry Zbysko in a steel cage match, a match that stemmed from one of the greatest heel turns of all time. It often gets forgotten in history, it gets overlooked a lot. You know, when people think of heel turns, they think of Hulk Hogan joining the NWO, or they think of, you know, Shawn Michaels causing Marty Jannetty to dive through the barbershop window to escape. Or even Andre's turn on Hogan in 87. That was a legendary moment when he linked up with Bobby Heenan to challenge Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania. But Zbysko in his Hall of Fame speech told the story about idolizing Bruno when he was younger and catching a glimpse of Bruno in his backyard in Pittsburgh one day, literally crawling through the hedges to get a better look. And Bruno had taken a liking to him, and he helped get him his start in the business. So years later, when Larry was making his way up, Bruno was already on his way down, Zbysko pitched an idea for Bruno to come out of retirement, because he was pretty much already retired from the ring. He would come out of retirement to work a program with Zbysko, which is what happened. It was the teacher against the student. Zbysko was tired in storyline of being in Bruno's shadow and being known only as Bruno's protege. So they had a friendly exhibition one week on TV, or what was supposed to be friendly. Bruno was frustrating him during the match, and so he turned on his hero. He took a chair, he bloodied him up. You know, by today's standards, this would be pretty standard stuff, I guess, but back then, this was a very big deal. And those two guys made some money doing business together all around the horn, including right here at Shea Stadium. 35 years ago this week, in St. Louis, on August 9th, 1986, Ric Flair won the NWA World's Heavyweight Championship for the fifth time, defeating Dusty Rhodes with the figure four leg lock. Tully Blanchard had viciously attacked Dusty's leg 2 days prior in Kansas City, which set up Rhodes passing out here from the pain and having his shoulders pinned to the mat. 27 years ago this week, on August 13th, 1994, ECW presented its first ever Hardcore Heaven show from the ECW Arena in Philadelphia, with a very famous finish to the main event between Cactus Jack and Terry Funk, who fought to a no contest after Public Enemy interfered just 5 minutes into the match and attacked Terry Funk. The show was running late, and they had to wrap up on time because the building had midnight bingo. The ECW Arena was quite literally a bingo hall. So they had to wrap things up. Cactus refused to pin Funk off of the interference from Public Enemy. He wasn't going to win like that. So he joined with him in battling Rocco Rock and Johnny Grunge. In the ensuing melee, Funk called for the fans to throw chairs to them in the ring, and what followed was a chaotic scene of well over 100 chairs being tossed into the ring as the ring announcer desperately pleaded with the crowd to stop throwing chairs into the ring. And it was to no avail. More chairs came flying in. Public Enemy was literally buried underneath all of the chairs. And promoter Todd Gordon was said to be furious about this, as you would imagine. I mean, just due to the potential lawsuits that could have resulted from something like this and somebody getting hurt. He was not happy. The funniest part, though, is one of the chairs hit Terry Funk in the back of the head, and just the comical way that he sold it. That was the best part of this whole thing. But that allowed him to fall down and give him an excuse to roll out to the floor to try to protect himself. Paul Heyman must not have hated it as much as Todd Gordon did, because the footage of this made it into the intro for their Hardcore TV show for years to come after this. But this was not the first chair-throwing incident instigated by Terry Funk. The first one came the month before this at their first ever Heatwave show, at the end of a barbed wire match with Terry and Dory Funk Jr. against Public Enemy. Funk, that night, grabbed a microphone and he asked the crowd for a chair. And he got a chair. About 75 of them. All four men also brawled out into the parking lot that night at the same time that dozens of old people were waiting in line for their midnight bingo game. I can just picture Terry Funk brawling out of the building all bloody, wrapped in barbed wire, while Grandma arrives for her bingo game, wondering if she's come to the wrong side of town. 25 years ago this week, on August 10th, 1996, WCW presented the first ever Hog Wild pay-per-view, an outdoor show from Sturgis, South Dakota, the site of the annual Sturgis Motorcycle Rally. This was an Eric Bischoff idea. Eric loves motorcycles, and he used to ride them a lot. So he thought it would be cool to ride the 8 hours down there on his bike to do a pay-per-view in front of thousands of bikers who clearly did not follow the product. They were honking their horns and revving their engines the entire time. A crowd that Bischoff on his 83 Weeks podcast suggested was made up mostly of everyday folks like doctors, lawyers, and engineers. They made no money on ticket sales because there were no ticket sales, although Bischoff claims the sponsorship opportunities that the show generated with automotive advertisers far exceeded whatever they would have made on the live gate. But a lot of the wrestlers hated it. I've heard Kevin Nash in particular and Conan talk about how logistically the show was just a friggin' nightmare. Nash said there were no locker rooms, they had to change in empty shipping containers, and the closest hotels were about 100 miles away in Wyoming. Bobby Heenan, who was doing commentary on the show with Dusty Rhodes and Tony Schiavone. Bobby Heenan, I love the Brain, but he was clearly shit-faced for much of this pay-per-view. It got progressively more noticeable as the show went on, right into the main event when he was starting to talk very low and he was slurring some of his words. The guy was hammered. If Tony Schiavone was sitting right next to him, he never saw him take a drink during the pay-per-view. Doesn't mean he didn't. Maybe he had a flask hidden away somewhere, or he could have done all of his drinking before the show, which is very possible. But he never saw him actually drinking during the pay-per-view. But he said he also sounded like he was either drunk, to him, or on pain pills. But in spite of the crowd, Chris Benoit and Dean Malenko had a very good match. In their match against the Steiner brothers, Harlem Heat got a ton of heat from the crowd. Hoo boy! These folks were revving their engines for Booker and Stevie. For all the wrong reasons. Stevie Ray, on his podcast a few years ago, compared what he and Booker felt like being there to being in Charlottesville, which is a hell of a comparison to make. There were some people, and I want to stress, some, I don't think it was the majority, but there were definitely people who were yelling racial slurs at them when the match was over. Some of them threw bottles and rocks at them on their way out. I imagine that if you would have told any of the people who did that Booker or Stevie were dating their daughter, they really would have been very unhappy. And Hollywood Hogan pinned the Giant to win the WCW World Championship, kicking off his year-long reign with the belt. This is where they spray-painted the NWO initials on the big gold belt for the first time. They desecrated the big gold belt. It's like sacrilege. They did 3 more of these Hog Wild shows before they finally gave up. They actually changed the name to Road Wild after this show due to a trademark lawsuit that they were looking to avoid with Harley Davidson over the Hog name. 24 years ago this week, on August 9th, 1997, One of the most violent matches of all time took place at ECW's Born to be Wired event from the ECW Arena in Philadelphia. This was not a pay-per-view. Highlights of some of the matches aired in the weeks that followed on TV. It was all about the main event. A barbed wire match with Terry Funk defending his ECW World Championship against Sabu. This match is sick and demented and not even very good. Like, let's just be honest here. I mean, as a match, even if you're a fan of this shit, this was not a good match. And it's hard to do a match like this, especially in this case where these guys are literally wrapped in barbed wire. It's hard to have a good pro wrestling match. Or anything that really is going to be very exciting. But it is memorable for the violence and Sabu ripping his bicep open on a spot in the corner. He ripped it right open, right down to the muscle. You can see him panic as soon as he realizes how bad the injury is. Then he calls for Bill Alfonso, his manager, to go find some tape so that he can tape the arm up and continue the match. And so Fonzie ran to the back and he grabbed some athletic tape, which is the only tape that he could find. He brought it back down to the ring and Sabu is taping his arm up. And while he's wrestling, he's trying to sell for Terry Funk. He's trying to sell for his offense while he is still wrapping his arm up. There was a point where Sabu crotched himself on the barbed wire. He wrapped barbed wire around his body. At another point, he dove off the apron with a leg drop onto Funk, who was laid out across a table. And for the finish, both men were wrapped in barbed wire. They were all tangled up. They couldn't do anything. So Sabu just held Funk's shoulders down for the three count to win the championship. It took them 20 minutes to cut both of these guys free with wire cutters because of how entangled they were in the wire. Backstage, Fonzie told Hannibal in his shoot interview on the Hannibal TV YouTube channel. He told him that they wanted to take, you know, they being the people in the back, the other wrestlers, wanted to take Sabu to the emergency room once he got backstage, but he refused and he told them, stitch me up right here. No anesthesia, just stitch me up right here. Which is what they did. And he said it took nearly 100 stitches to close the wound on his arm. And about midway through the stitching process, Sabu admitted to Fonzie, okay, this hurts. No shit. He said, this hurts. And he sends Fonzie to go find some super glue. And as he points out in his shoot, you know, these days they have medical grade super glue where you can very safely glue a cut shut to stop it from bleeding. Pretty amazing, the things they have today. But back then, they didn't have that. This was just over-the-counter shit from 7-Eleven that he sent Fonzie to go find. So Fonzie went to 7-Eleven, he bought a tube of super glue, and he gave it to Sabu, and he watched Sabu squeeze out a line of the stuff right down his arm and pinch the skin shut to close the wound. That's hardcore. That's very dumb. But that's hardcore. And Sabu told Chris Van Vliet the two most painful injuries of his career. And think about the ground that covers. Think about the matches, the wars that this man has been in, the scars. You can see the scars all up and down his arms, his chest. He told Chris that the two worst injuries of his career was the time Chris Benoit threw him in the air and he landed and he broke his neck. And the scar that he got on his arm when he wrestled Terry Funk. Paul Heyman told WWE.com years ago that it was the last barbed wire match in ECW history because he could not in good conscience subject anybody else to that level of brutality. For all that he endured here, Sabu's reign as champion lasted all of 8 days before dropping the belt to Shane Douglas. 2 days later, on the August 11th, 1997 episode of Raw is War from Biloxi, Mississippi, Ravishing Rick Rude returned to WWE after a 7-year absence as the new insurance policy for Shawn Michaels, assisting him to a victory over Mankind, and serving as one of the original members of D-Generation X, along with Michaels, Triple H, and China. And I am sure that was done as an inside joke that he was an insurance policy after he had been collecting money on an actual insurance policy for years through Lloyd's of London due to the back injury he sustained years earlier in WCW. Rude never really, to me, felt like a good fit for DX. He seemed miscast. Didn't really fit that group. And he wasn't with them very long anyhow. WWE had him on a per-appearance deal and not under an actual contract, which is why he was free to sign with WCW after what happened in Montreal. You know, he wanted out in protest of what they did to his friend Bret Hart, and he made history as the first man to ever appear on WWF, WCW, and ECW television in the same week. And also on this show, a moment that turned out to be kind of important, and it came during a match between Farouk and Chains of DOA, Rocky Maivia. He had been the clean-cut, smiling babyface since his debut, which led to chants of Die Rocky Die and Rocky Sucks. He suffered a knee injury in June, and he disappeared from television for 2 months until this match, where he slid into the ring behind the referee's back. There was a ref bump. That's what it was. There was a ref bump. He slid into the ring. He hit Chains with a rock bottom. And he handed the win to Farouk. This was the Rocky Maivia heel turn, joining the Nation of Domination, which gave rise to The Rock. I wonder whatever happened to that guy. 22 years ago this week, on the August 9th, 1999 episode of Raw is War, Chris Jericho made his WWE debut in what is, to this day, one of the greatest debuts of all time. I have it on my list as the second greatest debut in WWE history, behind only Kane in 1997. I mean, let's be honest here. I mean, Jericho, as cool as this all was, Jericho came out and he talked. Kane came out and he kicked ass. And he ripped the door off its hinges. And he laid out The Undertaker. I mean, come on. But that's not to take away from Jericho's first appearance. It was a little over a month earlier that WWE announced Jericho's signing on its website, something they did, according to Bruce Pritchard, to try to scoop the dirt sheets. Since they're going to announce it anyway, we'll announce it ourselves on our website. We'll go ahead and spoil the fact that Jericho is coming in. We'll just spoil it ourselves. He was unhappy with his position, Jericho was, in WCW, and he admits he backed out of a verbal commitment that he had made months earlier to Eric Bischoff, which Bischoff was not happy about. But as Jericho says, they took forever after they reached that verbal deal. You know, Bischoff and WCW took forever to send him an actual contract to sign. He would ask about it, and it took months, I think. And in that time, he ended up having a secret meeting in Stamford at Vince McMahon, or not even Stamford, in I guess Greenwich it would have been, at Vince McMahon's house. It wasn't even at the office. It was at Vince McMahon's house, at the McMansion. Had a secret meeting with Vince and some of the other WWE executives, and that was when he made the decision that he was going to make a break for it and leave WCW and try his hand in WWE. And for weeks on television, they aired these Millennium Countdown vignettes for someone or something counting down to Raw in Chicago on August 9th. And during his appearance on the Broken Skull Sessions with Steve Austin, Jericho explained how he came up with the countdown idea in the first place. He said, "I remember standing in line at the post office and there was a clock that said countdown to the millennium. And I remember thinking that would be a great way for somebody to come into the WWE. It would be a great way for me to come into the WWE. And that's when I said, I will be the Millennium Man. The countdown to the new millennium, that's me. And the Millennium Man is going to be a change, get rid of all the old and bring in the new. One of my opening promos was everybody in WWE was boring and I was the most entertaining guy and all this other stuff. And it came from the post office. I called Vince Russo and I told him this idea and he thought it was great. He called Vince McMahon, and here's the genius of it. We calibrated it so the countdown would end at the beginning of Raw, and I would open the show. But Vince said, no, you're going to come out in the middle of the show and interrupt a promo by The Rock, which to me is the genius of all geniuses. And that's what he did. He got a huge reaction as soon as the name Jericho appeared on the Titantron. People knew who he was. He cut a promo on how he was here to save the WWF, and he got to verbally joust with The Rock on his very first night in the company. It was great. The show was memorable for other reasons, too. Jesse Ventura, then the governor of Minnesota, made an appearance ahead of his refereeing gig at SummerSlam. I think he did some commentary that night, too. Kane and X-Pac beat the Acolytes to win the tag team titles, and after the match, X-Pac took away Kane's voice box device that he would use to speak, and he forced Kane to speak his first words without it, which were, "Suck it." To do it the way he did, it was like, "Suck it." That's a little bit closer to what he actually said. But the place popped huge for Kane telling everybody to suck it. Whatever it is. How very inspirational. And China pinned Triple H in the main event. A Falls Count Anywhere Triple Threat number one contenders match that also included The Undertaker to become the number one contender for the WWF title at SummerSlam. She would end up being the number one contender for all of 1 week. 21 years ago this week, on August 13th, 2000, WCW hosted its New Blood Rising pay-per-view from Vancouver, a mess of a show that featured Buff Bagwell against Chris Kanyon in a Judy Bagwell on a pole match, bro. Judy Bagwell being Buff's mom. She was actually not on a pole, but she was tied to a forklift and raised up while the forklift sat in the aisleway. Former WCW World Heavyweight Champion himself, David Arquette, who was in Vancouver filming a movie at the time, he made a surprise appearance during the match, attacking Bagwell, who made a comeback on both men, and won, and then rescued his mom. The match itself wasn't really all that bad, but the stipulation was, it was something else. Then came the Triple Threat match with Kevin Nash, Scott Steiner, and Bill Goldberg. And I mean this when I say this. This right here, to me, was the single worst thing that Vince Russo ever did. I know that's saying a lot, but this was the worst thing he ever did in WCW. This is the one thing that he did that just grinded my gears more than anything else. And it's one of the reasons he gets a lot of flack, and I think deservedly so. After the whole worked shoot deal the month before, at Bash at the Beach with Russo and Hogan, which turned into a real shoot, Russo went wild with the announcers dropping insider terminology on TV and just trying to replicate what he had done on that show. In this case, that included Goldberg, quote, going against the script and walking out in the middle of the match. So midway through the show, Tony Schiavone gets word that Goldberg has been in a motorcycle accident. He may not be able to make the show. Kevin Nash is skeptical, right, in storyline. Now, mind you, Russo had just turned Goldberg heel in June. Goldberg. Bill Goldberg. The hottest babyface this company ever created, who was still over, and who the people still wanted to cheer, and he turned him heel. So before the match, Tony Schiavone talks about who they think is going to go over during this match. Scott Hudson said that he thinks Kevin Nash has the political stroke to take the victory. Mark Madden, who is fucking terrible on these shows, picks Scott Steiner. Because if they want things to, quote, go down a certain way, and he doesn't want them to go down that way, then they're not going to go down that way. There's no discussion in any of this about the match itself as any kind of actual athletic competition. Only inside references to all this backstage bullshit. Goldberg did show up for the match. He showed up late. And when Nash goes to give him a jackknife powerbomb, Goldberg just shoves him away, and he walks out. And Nash looks stunned. Russo confronts Goldberg in the aisle and tells him to get his ass back in the ring. Goldberg says, fuck you, and he walks to the back. And the match continues with Nash and Steiner. And the commentary gets even more insufferable, with Madden wondering if maybe Goldberg was supposed to do something. Scott Hudson says he believes that Goldberg was supposed to go up for the jackknife, and instead he swerved Kevin Nash. It's like, Tony Schiavone wonders if the jackknife was part of the plan. And what are they going to do now? Improvise? This was actual commentary during this pay-per-view match. Nash went on to win the match. He became the number one contender for the WCW title. This led to an equally embarrassing... Actually, I think this was even worse. An embarrassing TV commercial promoting their Fall Brawl pay-per-view around the fact that Goldberg, and I quote, refused to follow the script. And now he would be wrestling Scott Steiner with no script. This was Russo at his dog shit worst. And you know, it's one thing to try to recreate your own Montreal Screwjob, as if we haven't seen that before. But you don't beat people over the head like they did here, with the fact that this is all fake. It was bad enough I had to listen to Vince McMahon on TV with Jim Ross talk about how Bret Hart didn't do the time-honored tradition. The worst thing that Russo has ever done, right here. This gets my vote. 20 years ago this week, on the August 13th, 2001 episode of Raw is War, from the Allstate Arena in Chicago, a dark day in wrestling as Stone Cold Steve Austin gives birth to the What chant. During the opening segment of the show, he came out with the Alliance. This was during the invasion period, heading into SummerSlam. See, he's alone in the ring. He's addressing all of the troops, all of the Alliance members who were circled outside the ring. And Austin was looking for someone to take out Kurt Angle tonight. But first, he's got to browbeat some people. And he calls Taz, Hugh Morris, and Raven into the ring. And Austin doesn't like that Chris Jericho beat Hugh Morris's ass last week. He goes, your name is Hugh Morris. What? Is that funny? Is that humorous? He did the same thing with Raven, he did the same thing with Taz, insulted them. And in the weeks that followed, he just kept doing it. With the What stuff, he would just randomly insert the What stuff in the middle of every single promo he did. Sold a lot of t-shirts, it was kind of fun at the beginning. But here we are 20 years later, and the fans still chant this. The single worst contribution Austin ever made to the wrestling business is that dumb What chant. And it all started with a rambling voicemail that he left for Christian while he was on the road. Christian said he wishes he had kept the message. Obviously, he deleted it a long time ago. But he was checking his messages, and there was one from Steve Austin, who said, I'm just passing a tree. What? I said, I'm passing a tree. What? And when he got to the arena, Christian asked him, what the hell is up with that voicemail that you left me? And Austin said, I don't know, I was just bored and I was rambling. Now, you know what? That does sound funny. 20 years ago. But not today. It's one of the few things I actually miss about the Thunderdome. No What chance. In an interview years ago with Sam Roberts, Austin said, everybody always says what ruins everybody else's promos. It does not. If you leave that gap in between your sentences, your words, your phrasing, don't interrupt your cadence and give them that end for the What chant. If you just keep talking like what I'm doing, I don't give you a chance to say it. That is true. But what he fails to realize is that not everybody is supposed to speed through their promos like a freight train. I mean, this is Steve Austin here, one of the greatest of all time. He knows that. He doesn't need me, Joe Blow, to tell him that, right? Every promo is different. Not everybody is out there when they're cutting a promo supposed to be speeding through it. You're supposed to take a breath every now and then. Although if they did speed through their promos like a freight train, how would WWE ever fill 3 hours of television every Monday night? That's why Paul Heyman talks to us like we're a child. He enunciates every single word, every syllable of every word. 17 years ago this week, on August 15th, 2004, at SummerSlam in Toronto, Randy Orton became the youngest World Heavyweight Champion in history at just 24 years of age, with a win over Chris Benoit. The next night on Raw, Orton was excommunicated from Evolution by a vengeful and jealous Triple H, who took the title from him only a month later, which did not do Orton any favors. The idea was that they would build him up as the babyface challenger to Triple H's title at WrestleMania the following year, but a funny thing happened. Batista got over as a bigger babyface than Randy Orton, and he ended up getting the spot instead and winning the championship at WrestleMania 21. Unlike Orton, Batista was quite a bit older when he won his first world title. Orton was 24, Batista was 36. 14 years ago this week, on August 12th, 2007, Adam Pac-Man Jones made his debut appearance for TNA Wrestling on the company's Hard Justice pay-per-view from the Impact Zone in Orlando. Jones played in the NFL at the time for the Tennessee Titans, and he was a very controversial figure, having been suspended without pay for the entire 2007 season into the beginning of the 2008 season for conduct detrimental to the NFL. He had been arrested 6 times since being drafted by the Titans, so Jimmy Uso has some catching up to do. Although Pac-Man's charges did not include DUI, but it included stuff like assault and felony vandalism, drug possession, disorderly conduct, and public intoxication. The most publicized incident, the worst of all these incidents, was a shooting that took place earlier that same year in Las Vegas at a strip club after he made it rain with hundreds of $1 bills. The club owner told one of his dancers to pick up all the bills, and Jones grabbed the woman by the hair and slammed her head on the stage, which led to a brawl between his entourage and a security guard who ended up being shot, allegedly by a bullet fired by one of Jones's men. There was another person who got shot who was paralyzed from the waist down. So naturally, only a few months later, TNA decided to bring him on in. Only the Titans didn't want him doing anything physical, and they filed a restraining order preventing him from doing so. They didn't want him to get hurt. So here on this show, he debuted for an in-ring interview with Mike Tenay. He had what at best I could call negative charisma. Ron Killings interrupted. He wanted to fight him. Security held him back. Later on in the pay-per-view, we learned that somebody had bloodied up Pac-Man Jones and left him for dead. By the time he made his Impact debut, he and Ron Killings, they had made amends. I guess he's a very forgiving man, Pac-Man is, having been left for dead on this show. And from there, the two of them would form Team Pac-Man. And not only do they end up challenging for the TNA Tag Team titles at the next pay-per-view, they win them! From Kurt Angle and Sting! With Pac-Man Jones not being able to do a single thing because he is not allowed to. But when Kurt Angle turns on Sting, Ron Killings allows Pac-Man to get the pin. He pinned Sting. And it only got worse from there. The entire Pac-Man saga, from beginning to end, was the very definition of wrestle crap. 10 years ago this week, on August 14th, 2011, SummerSlam came to the Staples Center in Los Angeles, a show that Jim Ross was told he would be calling with Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler, until he got to the building and he learned that they were using Booker T instead, because they wanted SmackDown represented on the show. So good old JR was relegated to Twitter duty for the night. This was the summer of Punk in WWE. He had won the WWE Championship from John Cena at Money in the Bank. He left with the title when his contract ran out, except he wound up signing a new contract, and they rushed him back to television a week later. After having held a tournament to crown a new champion, which was won by Rey Mysterio, who then lost the belt to John Cena on that same show. Got all that? So Punk returned with his title the same night, rendering the tournament completely pointless, but it allowed them to promote a title unification match in the main event at SummerSlam, which Punk won. And Triple H served as the guest referee. He didn't see John Cena's leg on the bottom rope when he counted the win for Punk, making him the undisputed champion. And then, out from the crowd, making his return to the company for the first time in years, comes Kevin Nash. And he sticks Punk with the jackknife powerbomb. He loves saying that whenever he's asked about this angle. He stuck him with it. He stuck him with the powerbomb. Which then allowed Alberto Del Rio to run out and cash in his Money in the Bank contract to win the WWE Championship for the first time. The first time the WWE title had changed hands at SummerSlam in 9 years, since Brock Lesnar's win over The Rock, and only the fourth time in history that the title had changed hands at SummerSlam, which is hard to believe, but it is true. We're talking the WWE title here, not the big gold belt. Only Bret Hart, Mankind, and Brock Lesnar had done it before this. I guess the Summer of Punk didn't really resonate here, though, because this show only did 296,000 pay-per-view buys, the lowest since that Heart and Soul show in 1997 before WWE business took off with the Attitude Era. From 97 to 98, the buy rate for SummerSlam shot up from 235,000 buys to 700,000 buys for the Highway to Hell pay-per-view. That's the power of Stone Cold Steve Austin right there. But Punk never did get his revenge on Nash like he was supposed to, because Nash claims he was taking a blood-thinning heart medication called Plavix, and he could not get cleared, so Punk lost to Triple H instead. The best match on the card, though, was not John Cena against CM Punk. It was Randy Orton regaining the World Heavyweight title from Christian in a no-holds-barred match. That was an excellent match. 5 years ago this week, on August 12th, 2016, Revolution Pro Wrestling hosted its Uprising event from York Hall in London, England, with a most unusual main event of Vader at 61 years old, and this was only 2 years shy of his death, against Will Ospreay. Now let's take it back to how this all got started. In June of that year, Ricochet and Will Ospreay had a match as part of the Best of the Super Juniors tournament that New Japan has every year. The match went viral. Clips of the match and a lot of the crazy just moves and dives, it looked like something out of a video game. And this thing went viral. It was very polarizing. Some fans loved it. Other fans thought that this is not pro wrestling. Vader was one of those very vocal critics on Twitter. He went on a nonstop tweet storm ripping on Ospreay. Clearly he was trying to get something going. And he ended, one of his tweets that he posted was asking the fans if they would be willing to pay to see him wrestle Ospreay and kick his ass. Now I believe that the story is that Will Ospreay is the one who went to the promoter at Rev Pro to request the match. The promoter had reservations about doing it, based on Vader's reputation, but he went to Vader, he pitched the idea, and Vader claimed all of his comments were just a work, which I don't believe. I mean, I do believe that he was angling for a match out of it, he played it up, but I absolutely believe that Vader looked at that match with Ospreay and Ricochet and thought that it was not what pro wrestling is supposed to be. 100% I believe that's what he honestly truly believed. But he was also smart enough to look at this and go, hey, maybe I can actually make some money off this. Both parties agreed to the match. It would be the 61-year-old super heavyweight Hall of Famer. Although he isn't in the WWE Hall of Fame, I don't think, which is pretty ridiculous. But he's a Hall of Famer in my book. The 61-year-old super heavyweight against the 23-year-old junior heavyweight. The biggest styles clash possible. Two generations colliding. And it was a great attraction for Rev Pro. They sold out the building with over 1,200 fans. Vader could not do much. He had health issues. He was 61. He was as heavy as I ever remember seeing him. I mean, just grossly overweight. So he couldn't do much, but he didn't have to. The heat was off the charts just when he made his entrance. Vader as the heel, Ospreay as the babyface. He attacked Ospreay before the bell and took out the referee. They fought up the ramp. Security got involved. They were going for the idea that Vader was shooting. So at least we didn't have to listen to the announcers on pay-per-view talking about Vader going against the script. That's the big difference between this and what I was just talking about with Russo a few minutes ago. But the crowd in the building was into it. Vader chokeslammed Ospreay through the announce table. Ospreay eventually recovered. He did a dive from the ramp onto Vader and the security guys and wiped him out. When it looked like Ospreay might actually win, Pete Dunne interfered. And he took out Will. And then he shook hands with Vader. Dunne was being very friendly with Vader. That brought out Ricochet, who beat Dunne earlier in the night. He took out Pete Dunne, and then with Ospreay's help, they double-teamed Vader, which makes sense, given that it was their match that Vader criticized that got this whole thing started in the first place. And they each hit shooting star presses to Vader, who kicked out. He kicked out of two shooting star presses. And Ospreay went after Pete Dunne again, but then Vader chokeslammed him. Ospreay kicked out at one, but then Vader followed that with an even higher chokeslam. I mean, Ospreay was bumping his ass off here. And this time, Vader got the pin, much to the surprise and the dismay and the anger and the rage of the crowd. Lots of "this is bullshit" chants. Vader flipped off the fans. Ospreay in his post-match promo implied, without directly saying so, that Vader refused to lose when he was talking about egos and wrestling. The original plan, this is per the Wrestling Observer at the time, the original plan was that Will Ospreay would win this match. And at first Vader agreed, but he didn't want it to be clean. And then a week before the show, he changed his mind and he said he wanted to win and he wanted to win strong. And then he would be willing to put Will Ospreay over in a rematch. But if you're the promoter, do you honestly believe that Vader is even going to fly back for a rematch? Once he gets his win in that first match that everybody wanted to see, can you trust that this man who already had, you know, a reputation that wasn't exactly great amongst the different independent promoters, do you trust that he is going to fly back and do the honors for this kid? So instead, the compromise they came to is they had Pete Dunne and Ricochet interfere with the idea that they would build to an eventual tag team match. It would be Vader and Pete Dunne against Ospreay and Ricochet. Well, there was no tag team match, and the rematch, the singles rematch, never took place. Instead, in October, Vader went on a Twitter tirade claiming that it wasn't he who requested to win the match, but a suggestion from the RevPro people that Ospreay would, you know, do the honors or wanted to do the honors, which is nonsense. It's complete bullshit. I don't believe that for a second. He also claimed that they were liars because part of his deal was that he would receive a copy of the match to sell in the United States. He says that he negotiated for the master tape and he had the email to prove it, which I don't recall him ever producing said email, which I would love to see. Why would RevPro agree to give him their master tape to sell copies of? What promotion would agree to such a thing? In November, a month later, Vader was in a rollover auto accident that almost killed him. He claimed that he was trapped upside down for over 30 minutes before being rescued. And less than 2 years later, he was dead. And 2 years ago this week, on August 11th, 2019, SummerSlam was in Toronto with a dream match for the ladies, the return of Toronto's own Trish Stratus, the 7-time women's champion against Charlotte Flair. Trish looked great, having not wrestled full-time in 13 years. She more than held her own. It was kind of a slow start, but it turned into what I thought was a very good match. You know, here's a woman who had the storybook retirement. She won the women's championship in her final match in her hometown of Toronto against Lita, probably her best friend and favorite opponent. They're still friends to this day. It was the storybook final chapter for Trish Stratus. So it was a little bit of a risk coming back here. So many years later, not knowing how she was going to look in the ring and how the fans would treat the match. So here she went down in defeat, but I thought they had a very good match. Bill Goldberg defeated Dolph Ziggler and destroyed him in less than 5 minutes. This was the perfect use of Goldberg and the perfect opponent. Nobody can bump their ass off better for Big Bill than Dolph Ziggler can. He sold those spears like death, like they cut him in half, like a knife through butter. This was also the night that Matt Riddle bumped into Goldberg backstage after all of the comments, all the shit talk that Riddle had made, the comments he had made about Goldberg, criticizing how he's not a wrestler, he doesn't know how to wrestle, he mocked his wrestling style. Goldberg even blocked him on Twitter at one point. Riddle was not yet on the main roster. He was with NXT. But he was there for one of those watch-alongs that WWE does on YouTube. And that night, he said he met Goldberg backstage, and he kept saying the word bro. I mean, after everything he says the word bro. So he was saying the word bro a lot, and finally Goldberg says, "I'm not your bro." Now, we did eventually get to see this. This was filmed, because they have cameras everywhere back there. Was it staged? Was it not staged? I'll say this. If it was staged, then Goldberg and all of them did a tremendous job of making it look as authentic as possible, because Goldberg looked like he wanted to rip this guy in half. Riddle actually looked I don't want to say nervous, like he was scared, but clearly he was not expecting to bump into Goldberg, and he seemed very nervous. He was kind of like nervously laughing, like, okay, bro, you know, like he didn't know kind of what was going to happen or what to say. It's a very awkward situation. But we did eventually get to see the footage, and Goldberg had this very disingenuous smile on his face as he was trying to pretend to be nice to Riddle. You know, if these two had come to blows, I think Riddle would have tied him up in knots if he wanted to. I mean, you got to remember, Riddle comes from an MMA background. He can more than hold his own in a fight. And he's a lot younger than Goldberg, too. I mean, Goldberg is still, he's still a strong guy. He's still a tough-looking guy. But, I mean, if these two came to blows, I think Riddle would tie him up and just embarrass him. Let us not forget, someone who is skilled and trained at such things. We had Chris Jericho years ago in a backstage fight with him and Goldberg. He put Goldberg in a front face lock and supposedly put him down. And Goldberg was trying, but he couldn't do anything because he was locked in a front face lock. So I don't care how big and tough and strong you are, if you have somebody who is trained, whether it's mixed martial arts or jiu-jitsu or amateur wrestling or whatever it may be, and they're young and they're able-bodied, they can embarrass you very quickly. But Riddle said this later. He said, "I think he has the belief, and it worked for him, that all he needs is a couple of moves in wrestling to be one of the best. And he has the spear and the jackhammer. My philosophy is you got to be good at everything. You got to talk. You got to be able to walk. You got to be able to grapple. You got to be able to suplex. You got to be able to do it all. So we disagree on that." Just recently, we saw Goldberg return to Monday Night Raw, right? To challenge Bobby Lashley to a match at SummerSlam for the WWE title. He and Riddle ran into each other again for the first time since that night at SummerSlam. And it sounds like they may have kind of, sort of made amends. This is what Riddle said. "Bill Goldberg is extremely entertaining. I can't take anything away from that, but I'll tell you this. I saw Bill the other day before he challenged Bobby Lashley, and he was walking to the gorilla position, and I was standing there with Damian Priest at the time, and he says hi to everybody, and then Goldberg comes up to me and gives me a look. He was making a face, and then he goes, 'Hey, congratulations, kid.' And I was like, 'Oh man, Goldberg is kind of nice.' So I gave him a little handshake and he went out and he challenged Bobby. And then he was coming back through Gorilla again and I was like, hey, Goldberg, good stuff. And as he gave me a fist bump, he says, I only need two moves. So I was like, oh man, this guy still got it. This show also featured the in-ring debut of The Fiend, Bray Wyatt, against Finn Balor. His entrance alone was the best thing on the entire show. That's how awesome this entrance, the presentation, the entrance, the music, all of it. He came out to a remix rock version of his old music. He had the Fiend mask on. He had this new lantern, which was a replica of his head, his own face. The eyes were sewn shut. The mouth was stretched out wide open. Freaked me out. Looked a little like Rob Zombie. I don't think I had ever seen someone get a holy shit chant just for their entrance until The Fiend did right here. And Balor got some limited offense, but not much, and Wyatt won with the mandible claw. And after The Fiend disappeared, when the lights came back on, Balor came too, the crowd chanted, "This is awesome." A tremendous debut. And sadly, a more epic fall for The Fiend. This was Balor's final main roster appearance for nearly 2 years, because 2 months after this, he returned to NXT television. And in the main event, Seth Rollins slayed the Beast and beat Brock Lesnar to win the Universal Championship, but he would not have it for very long. He lost it to The Fiend just 2 months later in Saudi Arabia. But before that, we had the horror that was Hell in a Cell 2019 and the main event on that show. The less said about that, the better. And that is this week in wrestling history. 3 weeks. That's how much we have left. 3 weeks of this week in history before it all comes to an end. You know, I had done this segment many years ago, around 2013, 2014, on the podcast, and after a 6-year absence, I decided to revive the segment. I thought people would enjoy it. I thought enough time had gone by, and I didn't cover everything back then. And so it was last September, on episode 668 of The Sound Off, that I revived This Week in Wrestling History. And so here we are. We are down to the final 3 weeks, and I hope you guys have enjoyed these segments. I am, right now, I'm planning on just starting to incorporate more mailbag Q&A like we used to do, you know, into the show, answering your questions, so you could email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. So that's the tentative plan right now, but the way things are looking, it's going to be Sound Off 720 on September 5th. That's All Out Sunday, AEW All Out. That day looks to be the final history segment, so I hope you guys have enjoyed it, and I hope you guys, when the segments are all up on YouTube, you'll check them out there. I got a whole playlist. If you missed any of them, every single history segment from the past year is archived in a playlist on the YouTube channel, and you can give those videos some love and leave comments there as well. Follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster, and also on Instagram. I am on Instagram. I am trying to be more active on there. TheSolomonster is my username on Instagram, so you can find me on there. And of course, if you would like to become a channel member on YouTube, we've picked up a whole bunch of new channel members over the last 10 days or so, and I want to thank everybody who has joined, either as a Sound Off superstar at the lower tier or a Sound Off legend at our top tier, where you get all the retro audio. Whichever one it is, I want to say thank you. Again, I am going to be recording a brand new video Q&A probably tomorrow, but definitely in the next 48 hours. I'm going to grab as many of your questions as I can. There's a post for members only on the YouTube channel under the community section. If you are a channel member, regardless of which level you're at, you will see a post that I put up on Saturday. And so there's a little bit of time left. If you haven't posted a question, that's where you can go to post. Try to just post one. I will try to get to as many of them as I can for a new video this week. Anything I don't get to, it'll spill over into the next one. But these are just members-only video Q&As where I just answer your questions. You ask the questions, I give you the answers, the best answer I can possibly give. So there's a brand new one that's going to be going up in the next few days for our YouTube family members. I'm going to be back with you for episode 718 next Sunday. This is a very busy week and a very busy weekend that is coming up. On Wednesday night, I'm going to be live on YouTube after Dynamite. Not entirely sure, but I might go live on YouTube Thursday night with SummerSlam predictions. That's 50-50 right now. We'll see. Friday night, I'm going to be live with you immediately after the first dance, AEW Rampage on TNT. So at 11 o'clock at night, Eastern, head on over to the YouTube channel. I have a feeling we're going to be talking about a pretty important event that's going to be taking place on the show that night. And then next Saturday is SummerSlam from Allegiant Stadium in Las Vegas, a rare Saturday night WWE pay-per-view. I'll be live on YouTube after that. And live on YouTube next Sunday. Two podcasts in one day. You're going to get 718, and then Sunday night, I'll be live with my TakeOver 36 review for the next NXT TakeOver. Samoa Joe challenging for the NXT Championship against Karrion Kross. And, of course, Walter defending his United Kingdom title against Ilya Dragunov, which has the potential to be the match of the year. I'm very much, through all of this NXT turmoil and these changes that are going on, I know a great match when I see one. That's going to be a great match. So I'm looking forward to seeing TakeOver and all the other shows coming up this week. Until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a fantastic rest of your week. A lot of wrestling coming up this week. And I hope you will choose me for your coverage for all of it. See you live on YouTube. Take care, guys.
The Salamonster sounds off.
What is the point of Tony Schiavone even coming down to the ring to do these interviews if every single time they pull the microphone out of his hand? There were a couple of AEW diehards who got very upset. Oh my God, you're criticizing. But these will be the first fucking people. If WWE did something like this, oh, they'd be online. Oh my God, WWE, look at this. What a shit product. God forbid you say something negative about AEW. Holy shit. The world is just falling down all around us. You people gotta cool your jets. Don't tell me what to tweet on my Twitter. You can go fuck yourself.
The Salamonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesalamonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow the Salamonster on Twitter @Salamonster.
Salamonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Salamonster Sounds Off.